You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
The key to the whole game of Wall Street and the gods of money is debt slavery. The key to the whole game, the thing that Reaganomics said is irrelevant, is the central point about the whole game of bankers since the creation of Babylonian banking. It's debt. Debt slavery.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, William Engdahl. Today's show, The Gods of Money, How America Was Hijacked. William Engdahl is an international political analyst and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss his book, The Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century. William Engdahl, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you again, Bonnie.
In your introduction to Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, you write that this book is not a conventional account of money, banking, or economics, but rather a history of power, a history of the colossal abuse of power in the hands of the gods of money. Who and what are you referring to as the gods of money?
What I refer to and what I trace out in the book from the earliest beginnings, in fact, with the Alexander Hamilton First National Bank of the United States, which wasn't a national bank but was a Rothschild bank, what I trace out is the gods of money are the international bankers that buy and sell nations. They finance wars like the Napoleonic Wars, the War of 1812 against the United States when the U.S. was abandoning the Rothschild Bank of the United States. And these so-called gods of money see themselves as above nations, above people, literally as gods. And there's an expression by Henry Kissinger back in the 1970s when he was at the zenith of his power. He said, if you control the oil, you control nations or groups of nations. If you control the food, you control the people. If you control the money, you control the entire world. And that, in essence, is the agenda of the gods of money, what I call the gods of money. That's with a small g, by the way.
You write that money is nothing more and nothing less than a political creation, a promise to pay, backed up by the government and its military power, and obviously also it's the government's ability to tax that gives it such enormous power. But if the government is what backs up the value of money, then how is it that banking is in private hands?
Well, that's the great mystery of the last, I would say, 500 years of Western civilization. When the city of London began to rise in the 1690s with the Bank of England and so forth, these were private merchant bankers creating a bank called the Bank of England, and they lent to the crown to finance wars against France, against whoever, and because the crown did not understand the power of money, they didn't. Most governments, including the communist governments, Karl Marx, years ago I studied when I was in Sweden, I studied Das Kapital and Karl Marx, and Karl Marx never understood the fundamentals, or didn't want to understand, of central banking and the creation of money. And this is kind of the secret of secrets, the inner sanctum of power that we never seem to get our hands around. There are a bunch of gangsters and crooks called the gods of money or the banks of Wall Street. There are only about seven of them, really. There's Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, four or five others, J.P. Morgan Chase, and so on. And they have systematically, over the course of the period since World War II, step by step created a silent coup d'etat, taking over every institution of influence in the American body politic. They've ripped up the Constitution. They've financed wars, the wars in the Middle East and so forth. They stand behind the military-industrial complex that is booming these days because of all the wars. And they control the Federal Reserve. They created the Federal Reserve. You know, many people have the illusion or the wrong information that the Federal Reserve is a solemn U.S. government institution. It's nothing of the sort. It's a private central bank controlled by private capital, controlled by J.P. Morgan Chase, by AIG at times and so forth. And its stock is owned privately, the central bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, being the most powerful of the various reserve banks. So if you can control the power of money, the Constitution of the United States is a fairly decent document as these things go. And the founding fathers gave the power to print and coin money to the Congress of the United States. Well, in December of 1913, in a coup d'etat, J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Bank, with Woodrow Wilson as their hired hand, their paid gun, created the Federal Reserve Act that took that power away from the elected U.S. Congress and put it in the hands of the private bankers, the international bankers of Wall Street. And those are who I refer to as the gods of money with a small g, because they see themselves as gods. Maybe the title, if I were to rewrite the book today, I would probably change the title, because it gives them too much respect, because they are no gods. They're pathological. If you look at people like David Rockefeller or the chairman of Goldman Sachs or Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, these are psychopaths. These are people without any emotions whatsoever.
At the beginning of our interview, you mentioned the War of 1812 against the United States, when the U.S. was abandoning the Rothschild Bank of the United States. Were you referring to the first bank of the United States set up by Alexander Hamilton? And what did the War of 1812 have to do with the abandonment of this national bank?
Well, this is one of the most fascinating stories of the power of money and war and so forth in American history, I think. In 1791, when the nation was just being founded, Alexander Hamilton, who was a British monarchist till his dying days, had the trust of President Washington, and he wrote a proposal for creating a Bank of the United States. Now, most historians, the shocking thing is I delved into this when I was researching the book several years ago, most historians, American historians, think this was a national bank, a Bank of the United States. It in no way was.
the details of the charter of the Bank of the United States that Hamilton set up in 1791 called for 80% of the stock to be held by private interests, including foreign private interests, if they so choose, and only 20% was in U.S. government control. So it wasn't at all a Bank of the United States. It was a bank in the United States, controlled, and as it turned out, controlled by the City of London, which was the dominant financial power back in 1791 by far. And the dominant financial power in the City of London was the House of Rothschild, Barings, and a few other banks. So the charter for the Bank of the United States, by the way, there was bitter political opposition when the Hamilton proposal was presented to Congress, led by Thomas Jefferson, who I have to say history has treated him, to my mind, a little bit unfairly. Thomas Jefferson said a Bank of the United States should be in the hands of the government as the framers of the Constitution intended it to be, and not in private interest hands. Well, Congress passed it, and it was a 20-year charter. In 1811, the charter came up for renewal, and because of the performance, the track record of the Bank of the United States for the economy, which wasn't that great, the Congress voted not to renew it. 1 year later, in 1812, the British made several economic and financial provocations against the United States, and President James Madison went to the Congress and asked for a declaration of war against England for these affronts, which Congress granted, and that became the so-called War of 1812. But in fact, it was provocations that were instigated by the City of London, by N.M. Rothschild's, Nathan Rothschild's Bank, and Barings Bank, and a few others. At that time, the British were involved in the Napoleonic Wars on the continent. Perhaps the calculation was they could settle some scores with England regarding Canada. I don't know. This is only speculation, but at that point, Madison was not in favor of the recharter of the Bank of the United States. He agreed with Thomas Jefferson that the bank was a private entity that was not good for the national economy. But the war, the British, the famous story of the British Navy bombing Washington at the Battle of New Orleans, Indian wars up in the American-Canadian border and so forth. It went on for 2 or 3 years, and as a result of the war, the American government had a 300% increase in its federal debt. And at that point, in 1816, the New York bankers stepped in and persuaded Congress and persuaded Madison to change his view and create a second Bank of the United States. The same program, 80% of the shares were held by private interests, including the City of London banks. And Nicholas Biddle, a personal friend of Nathan Rothschild in London, became the governor of the Second National Bank. They controlled all government debt of Washington. All of the tax revenues of Washington were on deposit in Philadelphia at the Second Bank of the United States. So it was literally a coup d'etat by these private bankers, using the war and the war debts and the inability to finance the war to convince Madison to change his view and support the new Bank of the United States. A very tragic development, by the way.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, The Gods of Money, How America Was Hijacked. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. In 1832, President Andrew Jackson vetoed the renewal of the Second Bank of the United States, but the private bankers fought back. I understand that there was even an unsuccessful assassination attempt on Jackson. What happened there?
The renewal of the charter, it hadn't yet expired, but Andrew Jackson was a fierce foe of the New York banks and the bankers that owned the bank, Second Bank of the United States, Philadelphia, Nicholas Biddle, and so forth. He blamed them for a nationwide agricultural depression in the western states and the Midwest and so forth, correctly. And he said the Bank of the United States, where the U.S. government does its business, should not be controlled by foreign banks. So he, in 1832, he vetoed an early attempt by supporters of the bank to renew the charter a couple of years before it was due. As a result, Nicholas Biddle, in cahoots with Nathan Rothschild, his good friend in London, and James Rothschild in Paris, created the Depression of 1837 in order to punish or to force the Congress to change their mind. The Bank of England was involved. This has been well documented in my book, The Gods of Money, to try to force the United States and the president into renewal of the charter. It failed. And from that point, 1837, until 1913, when the same Wall Street banks with the City of London backing made a coup d'etat called the Federal Reserve Act with Woodrow Wilson, there was no privately owned central bank of the United States.
President Abraham Lincoln had the U.S. Treasury issue legal tender notes, or greenbacks, to finance the Civil War, rather than borrow from private bankers in New York and London at outrageous interest rates.
Yeah.
Lincoln was assassinated a few days after the end of the Civil War. What do we now know about his assassin, John Wilkes Booth? And did Lincoln's murder have anything to do with banking?
Oh, it had very, very much to do with banking and the decision by Lincoln and his Treasury Secretary to issue greenbacks, government-printed money that were backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. Had the United States lost the Civil War, of course, the holders of those greenbacks would have held green paper, but that wasn't to be. And the London banks were furious with Lincoln because he was able to finance the Civil War without reliance on private banks in London and Wall Street. The private banks wanted to charge 24, in some cases, 36% interest to make loans to the U.S. government. And Lincoln's greenbacks, the so-called free legal tender notes, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, totally destroyed those plans. So 5 days after the surrender at Appomattox by General Lee of the Confederacy, Lincoln was assassinated by a third-grade actor named John Wilkes Booth. And here, the interesting point is, like Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination, the Congress and the Attorney General and the relative authorities immediately said, it's a lone assassin, we don't need to investigate. Well, had they investigated, they would have found out that Wilkes Booth was lured by Judah Benjamin, the treasurer of the Confederacy, to murder Lincoln. And the details of this are very, very convincing. Of course, like with the Lee Harvey Oswald Kennedy assassination, we may never get the, you know, the direct fingerprints on the gun. But Wilkes Booth and Judah Benjamin were acquainted. Benjamin was very close to British Prime Minister Disraeli and to Nathan Rothschild in the City of London, who was a sponsor of Disraeli. And immediately when Lincoln was assassinated, Judah Benjamin fled to London, the only leading member of the Confederacy government never to return to the United States. And there were various reasons why the City of London would want Lincoln assassinated. Number one was the greenbacks, because Lincoln had discovered a way of outflanking the private banks and financing the infrastructure and redevelopment projects of the U.S. government by direct issue of interest-free money, the greenbacks. And Lincoln's post-war plans for the South were a very mild reconstruction that would allow the economy of the South to return to agriculture production. And at that point, the City of London banks were the leading grain traders and cotton traders of the world. And the last thing they wanted was to have the southern states of the United States to come back on the market at that point, because the price of cotton would collapse and their profits with it. The other thing is, Lincoln opposed to bring the United States back onto the London gold standard. And the gold standard in those days was controlled by the banks of the City of London. So they used that to control the world economy, much like the price of oil after 1973, and the Federal Reserve controlled the world economy through that. So London's wish was for a brutal reconstruction in the South with carpetbaggers and all of this, and disruption of the agriculture production so the grain and cotton prices would go up. And in 1934, interesting enough, a Canadian attorney named Gerald McGeer was given confidential information by someone who had the documents that John Wilkes Booth was a mercenary paid by the international bankers. And in 1875, Congress repealed the issue of greenbacks, called them back in, and declared the Specie Resumption Act of a return to the British gold standard. So it was a victory for the City of London and a loss for the United States, by the way.
In your chapter, JFK Outfoxes the Fed, you note that President John Kennedy was concerned with getting the economy out of a seven-year recession. You write that, quote, 5 months before his assassination, by what was decades later revealed to have been a CIA hit team, Kennedy issued an all but unknown proclamation, which may have cost him his life. What proclamation were you referring to?
He had the U.S. Treasury print United States government silver certificates, money backed not by the private banking interests of the Federal Reserve. Look at your dollar bill today, and it says Federal Reserve note. The Federal Reserve is a private bank. It's owned by private bankers. Look at the stock ownership of the New York Federal Reserve, the most important of those. And you'll see what I'm saying. This is one of the great mythologies of American history, is that the Federal Reserve has something to do with control by Washington and the United States government. That control was given up in December of 1913 when Woodrow Wilson, in an act of, I would call it, treason against the United States, signed the Federal Reserve Act to appease his banker friends who financed his presidential campaigns. So I think that was not the only reason for the Kennedy assassination. I think, in general, the vested interests, the oligarchy, and Kennedy was no stranger to the oligarchy. His father was one of them, as ambassador to the Court of St. James in London. But Kennedy had his own agenda, and it was an interesting agenda. It was an agenda that called for detente with Russia. He was terrified, personally, according to all accounts I've seen, privately, by the closeness with which the United States and the Soviet Union came to a mutual nuclear annihilation during the Cuba Missile Crisis. That was a crisis that was engineered by Allen Dulles and the CIA behind Kennedy's back. And one of the reasons I think Kennedy was assassinated is that Alan Dulles, as head of the CIA, never forgave John F. Kennedy for kicking him out of the CIA. Kennedy actually had plans, if he had been reelected, to abolish the CIA, which would have been one of the more positive things for American post-World War II history. The CIA today is one of the most destructive institutions in the American political matrix. It's a rogue institution. There is nothing legitimate about the mission it has. It's completely out of control of Congress or any elected official. And it has a dark agenda. And I think the dark agenda really became extreme under the leadership of George Herbert Walker Bush Sr. in 1976 when he was made director of intelligence at the CIA. And from that, a takeover of American political institutions by the CIA began to become high priority, financed by drug monies from Colombia, by Vietnam, male tribesmen, heroin finances, and so forth for the Vietnam War. So that was another factor, and I think there was a consensus among various factions. Kennedy was also about to de-escalate, by all accounts of people close to him. He was about to pull CIA advisors out of Vietnam and write it off as a bad idea to try to support this corrupt dictatorship in South Vietnam against the communist North. And the military-industrial complex was not at all happy about that because they wanted a splendid little war to jack up their military spending budgets from Congress, and that became the Vietnam War. Lyndon Johnson hated the Kennedy brothers. There was bad blood between the both of them, but it was a political marriage of convenience that he'd become vice president and bring the southern states in to help the election of Kennedy in 1960. So evidence is that Lyndon B. Johnson was in on the plot, that his former mistress gave an interview to British television decades later, telling her account of what he told her. So once he was president, Lyndon Johnson took every order that the military gave about ramping up the war in Vietnam, and American history was changed for the worse with that, as we all know. So there were many reasons, but one of them was, I think, Kennedy's inclination to look at the possibilities of going outside the Wall Street investment banks that control the marketing of U.S. debt, U.S. government debt, and looking at the possibilities of doing that directly, interest-free and creation of currency by the government. That would have saved the United States of America and American taxpayers trillions by now, trillions of dollars in taxes, to simply pay the banks of Wall Street for managing the government debt.
Were Kennedy's United States notes, rather than Federal Reserve notes, ever printed?
Yes, they were. And the first thing that Lyndon Johnson did when he became president was to close it down. He did what he was told, and that Johnson was not going to rock the boat of the establishment.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, The Gods of Money, How America Was Hijacked. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You often quote Henry Kissinger's famous line, which you've mentioned, that if you control the money, you control the entire world. How is it that control of the currency turns out to be the most powerful control, even more than oil and food?
Go back, Bonnie, to the Bretton Woods conference in 1944. That conference was run by the U.S. Treasury and the four or five international Wall Street banks. especially the Rockefeller Citigroup. And what they arranged was that the entire free world monetary order of Bretton Woods would be oriented toward the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar would be the only currency convertible for gold. The dollar was, quote, as good as gold. And at that time, the Federal Reserve held something like 70% of the monetary gold in the entire world. So they were sitting in hog heaven. You know, there was no challenger on the face. Europe was a rubble heap after the war. Japan was in ashes, thermonuclear ashes, thanks to Harry Truman and the Pentagon. China was undergoing an internal revolution. The Soviet Union was devastated, 27 or 29 million killed in order to win World War II for the United States, effectively. So at that point, they created a system that was based on the dollar. And if the dollar is the reserve currency held by every other nation's central bank, then they have to finance everything, all their trade, their purchase of oil, their purchase of raw materials on the world market in dollars. So they have to come up with those dollars somewhere. And that creates a demand for dollars that allows the United States to run a balance of payments deficit since 1971, almost every single year, with the exception of one or two years during Clinton's regime when the Social Security baby boom spike created a little bit of a surplus. So the dollar as reserve currency is one of two pillars, as I often write in my articles and books, two pillars of American hegemony or American power. The second pillar is that the U.S. military shall be second to none in the world. So those two, the dollar is reserve. What does that mean, dollar is reserve currency, if the U.S. runs a deficit? Well, China has a trade surplus. Germany has a trade surplus. What do they do with the surplus dollars? They buy U.S. Treasury bonds. What does that allow the U.S. government to do? Run a deficit without even blinking an eye so that the Chinese de facto are financing U.S. military operations that are against Chinese national interests, that are against German national interests in NATO and so forth. The coup d'etat in Ukraine in 2014, a good example of that. German industry suffered grievously from that coup d'etat. But that is because the dollar is reserve currency still to this day. Now, the euro back in 2000 or so, when it 2002, when it became a functioning alternative currency, even though it had grave flaws in its design, there was no political central government for United States of Europe like in the US of A. But despite that, the euro was on its way to become an alternative to the dollar, because at that point, George W. Bush was running, after the 2008 financial crisis, was running annual deficits of $1 trillion, $1.3 trillion. It was just skyrocketing out of control. The Chinese said, we are not at all amused by the level of indebtedness of the U.S. government, because our previous investments in U.S. debt is becoming endangered if this continues. And they started moving their surplus, trade surplus, into euros. And at that point, Washington, the U.S. Treasury, Financial Warfare Unit, and so forth, reacted together with Wall Street with an attack on the weak link of the euro, namely the Greek debt, fraudulent Greek debt, which Goldman Sachs had arranged for the Greek government a few years before. So this is the kind of thing, if you can create money out of thin air and everybody else is required to get that money, that U.S. dollar, then you have a power that's just awesome.
Yes, it is ironic that, as you point out, it's the U.S. government's indebtedness because of the reserve currency status of the dollar. Other countries are having to finance the U.S. military to attack them.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works out. And only slowly are they beginning to realize this. The Chinese, I think, began to realize this around 6 or 7 years ago. But they had so much more than $1 trillion invested in U.S. Treasury debt. If they dump it all at once, some people say, dump it all at once, bankrupt the U.S. No, it doesn't work that way. If they do that, then China will go through a horrendous financial crisis. So they have to figure out some way. And what they're doing is buying gold, the same as the Russians. They're buying every bar of gold they can get their hands on in the market. The cheaper, the better, but even if they pay a premium. And ultimately working toward creating a gold-backed renminbi or yuan as an alternative to the dollar, at a point where the dollar becomes recognized worldwide as a completely worthless paper currency.
One thing that I never completely understood is why it is that the central banks of other countries use their surplus dollars to buy U.S. Treasury notes. Is there nowhere else for them to put those dollars?
Not in the dimensions, for example, China, or before that in the 80s, it was Japan. They had tens or hundreds of billions of dollars in trade surplus, mostly with the U.S. That was the diabolical thing. You can buy Japanese cars in the U.S. They said, come on in. We don't care about Detroit. Buy our cars because you'll finance our debt. And we can make wars and take over other countries and loot them. And, it works out okay. And that's kind of how it works. So there are almost no alternatives. The euro was the most promising potential alternative back in 2007, 2008. And money was going into the euro from Japan, from China, from Russia, from other countries to buy bonds of the European governments. And that's why the Greek crisis was triggered by the U.S. Treasury Financial Warfare Unit in 2010 to stop the attraction of the euro as an alternative to the dollar. And it pretty well succeeded short term.
Well, is the Wall Street financial warfare against the EU, against the euro, that is that continuing today?
Sure. I think, in effect, what the Trump administration is doing is targeting the euro itself for demolition. And that will create quite a bit of disruption in the European economies, I can assure you. But they smell that this is the Achilles heel, that to eliminate any potential future threat to the hegemony of the U.S. dollar, they should just finish off this euro thing once and for all. The Brexit began the tumbling of the dominoes called the Eurozone. Believe me, I'm for stability and tranquility and all these things. The European Union is a Frankenstein monster. It has nothing to do with the original intent of Charles de Gaulle or Adenauer back in the 60s when they talked about a Europe of the fatherlands, where national sovereignty would be the foundation stone of cooperation agreements between the member nations, that time 6 or 7. Now it's become this undemocratic, unelected, faceless, supranational bureaucracy of de facto, let's call it what it is, fascists, who want top-down control over every facet of life of citizens in the countries of the European Union. They want to dictate to countries such as Hungary or Germany or whoever how many war refugees they must take and integrate into their economies. Well, what is this all about? You know, who's causing the wars? It's NATO. Who's causing the Arab Spring? Who's causing this Syria thing? It's the United States Pentagon. It's the CIA. It's the State Department. It's Turkey. It's Qatar. It's Saudi Arabia. So why should Europe have to accept millions of war-crazed refugees, many of them terrorists? What is this? This isn't about humanitarianism. Never a country in the world opens its borders to anybody without questions asked. America never did that. You have to have certain criterion of who you want to be a citizen in your country, who you deem can assimilate into your culture, learn your language, and so forth. But in Europe, Angela Merkel and the governments in Brussels have just opened the floodgates because certain interests like George Soros, the European Council on Foreign Relations and so forth, the Vatican, Pope Francis, they want to destroy national identity. And I think borders matter. I think national identity matters. And I think national currencies matter. Not supranational things like the Euro or the Brussels Commission or the European Parliament that has no connection to voters.
How does the expansion and contraction of the money supply create booms and busts, or what is called the business cycle? How is the lending power of banks used to create deflationary recessions and depressions?
If I flood the market with cheap money, people take that money and they buy houses, they flip those houses, the money keeps flowing, so somebody buys the flipped house and the price goes up even more and there's no new value added to that physical piece of real estate, but the market price is going up. So as long as the capital flows, it's a party with a huge punch bowl. But when somebody takes away the punch bowl, the central bank, and pulls back the money supply, suddenly nobody can pay their debts because this is all based on debt. The key to the whole game of Wall Street and the gods of money is debt slavery. The key to the whole game. The thing that Reaganomics said is irrelevant is the central point about the whole game of bankers since the creation of Babylonian banking. It's debt. Debt slavery.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, The Gods of Money, How America Was Hijacked. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, how do banks flood the economy with money? Is it simply by making a lot of loans?
Yes. Well, it's called the fractional reserve banking system. You can make loans against capital of, it's changed a little bit in recent years, but between 8% and 11%, you can multiply that manifold and simply create money out of thin air, the banks. And then the Federal Reserve is kind of the governor or the policeman to keep that within certain bounds, but under Greenspan, those boundaries were more or less abolished. So the key to the thing, I think, was the decision of the U.S. government to agree that Wall Street bankers, international bankers in Wall Street, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and so forth, would buy the debt of the United States and resell it. So private bankers would make the profit. And the Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, around the time of President Lincoln, suggested, well, if the U.S. Treasury created a fund of, I don't know, he said X hundred million dollars, but let's say a few billion dollars in today's money, and we use that as collateral to issue the debt of the United States directly to citizens, we don't need these private bankers to rake off 40, 30, 25, 50% profits on the backs of the U.S. taxpayer. Well, that got deep-sixed by the power of J.P. Morgan and others. And they create banking panics to panic politicians to increase their control. It's very simple, really. If you control the money, you control the world. If you're dependent on money in your job and I say, I cut you off, you don't get any money, what do? You're in a panic. Well, you do that with the whole nation through the money supply, the central money supply. That's why the gods of money created the Federal Reserve as a private instrument to control the money supply and take it away from the entity that the Constitution of the United States mandated, namely the elected U.S. Congress. So the fractional reserve banking system collapses periodically, about every 10 years or so, and the same thing repeats itself, and the power of those banks increases and increases because they create money out of thin air, and that money is a promise to pay. Backed by what? Since 1971, August, the U.S. dollar is backed not by gold, no longer. It was backed by oil revenues after the 1973 oil shock, which Henry Kissinger managed to manipulate. And then, in the present day, I would say the dollar is backed by nothing more than the power of Abrams tanks and F-16 fighter jets. Raw military power on the rest of the world. And you accept those promises to pay called U.S. Federal Reserve notes that are worthless pieces of paper. Look at the size of the federal debt of the United States government. What is it, $19 trillion today? What was it 10 years ago? What was it 20 years ago? Put that on a graph and look at the trend, and you get an idea that something is really rotten in the state of the United States, and it's called debt.
The last chapter in Gods of Money deals with some of the similarities between America's current situation and that at the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. For one thing, you mentioned that both empires relied on looting and plunder to sustain themselves. What are some of the other similarities?
Well, the indebtedness, the destruction of citizen farmers. They were forced to go to war to extend the Roman Empire to the borders of France and England and East Germany and so forth. And to loot that, to feed this parasitical class called the Roman senators, the Roman patriarchy. And in Rome itself, it was just debauchery, corruption. You buy and sell senators and offices and so forth. It was a slave society. It wasn't always that way. At the time of Julius Caesar, it was quite other. But step by step, the money interests took over and destroyed anything positive in Rome. And that's very similar to what the banks have done over the past 40, 45 years to anything positive in the United States of America. Follow the sequel, 1999. The Bill Clinton administration abolishes the Great Depression laws called Glass-Steagall, which mandated a separation between investment banks that buy and sell stocks and bonds from commercial banks that finance corporations. And you had the growth of the power of the six or seven mega banks of Wall Street after 1999 and Bill Clinton's great signing of that disgusting act, such that the balance sheets of those six or seven banks are larger than the gross domestic product of most of the nations of the world. This is crazy. You give so much power, and then they come up with this nonsense doctrine, too big to fail. I say they're too big to save. Let's nationalize them. Let's carve them up, chop them down to size, take away all their power so they can't buy and sell presidents, they can't buy and sell congressmen on the banking committee and other committees to extend their power. This goes back to Babylon. This is the power of money. This is the power of debt slavery and the banks. That's what destroyed the British Empire, what destroyed the Dutch Empire. It's what destroyed Venice, and it's what's destroying, if we allow it, the United States of America. Simple as that. Look at the banks. Look at those bankers. Why aren't they in jail? Why isn't Jamie Dimon doing a stiff sentence in prison, the chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase? Why is he sitting there with a grin on his face today? Because we allow him to. We feel pathetic. We feel powerless. And these people have no power. They have only the power that we give them. So the empire of the United States and the empire of Rome are similar in so many ways. And the corruption in Rome and the corruption in Washington, I won't begin to talk about it, but it's so similar. Compare Washington of the 1950s or the early 1960s with Washington today, with the kind of scandals you have, the sex scandals, the pederasty scandals, you name it, and the corruption scandals, money under the table, and so forth. It's Rome in the fourth century.
Well, then essentially having a central bank underneath the U.S. Treasury and then having the government itself have the power to create credit, that would be a better system, right?
Far better. Far better, but I would call it not a central bank, a national bank. A real national bank controlled by the nation with the electorate having the power to vote in or vote out presidents and Congress who misuse the powers of that national bank. And that's what the founding fathers had intended with the Constitution. Woodrow Wilson signed that away in December 1913 because he was bought and paid for by J.P. Morgan and Company in Wall Street. It's simply time to take that power back for the American people in an intelligent way. Take those six or seven banks that are destroying the nation, nationalize them as a national security priority, not as some socialist thing like Henry Paulson claimed it was. A national security priority for the good of the nation, the survival of the nation. Get rid of their toxic debt, put it into a fish tank and sort it out over the course of the next 20 to 30 years, what real estate is worth and what is not. And use the power of the state, the good power of the government, to do something positive. I think the better thing is to use credit to create productive economic projects like high-speed rail lines, like infrastructure. America has an $8 trillion estimated infrastructure deficit. Now we have the private power of robber banks. It's the robber barons all over again, destroying the nation and saying it's free enterprise. It's free for them. That's, I think, a good beginning. If I were a president and wanted to drain the swamp, I would start with the seven banks of Wall Street.
In your book, Gods of Money, you quote Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman and CEO of the world's most profitable bank, Goldman Sachs, as having said in an interview that he was merely a banker doing God's work. What do you think he meant by that?
A banker doing God's work is the gods of money. That's why I titled the book that, by the way.
William Engdahl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie. I really enjoy talking with you about these various themes. It's very important, and it's important that more Americans have an idea of the actual history that has taken their country and our country to the point where it is today, that it's been hijacked by a bunch of criminals called bankers, Wall Street bankers,
And after the events of the crisis of 2008, instead of being put on trial as they were in countries like Iceland and put into prison for crimes against the nation and crimes of criminal fraud, those bankers like Blankfein and Jamie Dimon and others got increased bonuses. They're sitting as the gods of money. And now under the Trump presidency, it looks like the Security Exchange Commissioner is going to roll back even the modest attempts to rein in some of the abuses of the Wall Street banks that led to the 2007-2008 meltdown, and let them just have free rein. So if we want to be ruled by a bunch of psychopathic bankers, we should know what we're saying yes to. That's my view. That's why I wrote the book.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with William Engdahl. Today's show has been The Gods of Money, How America Was Hijacked. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics, and The New World Order. Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. His book, Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Visit WilliamEngdahl.com to sign up for a free bi-monthly geopolitical newsletter. That's William, ENGDAHL.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio. Hey!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a fascinating look at a natural resource we had better get serious about conserving. The elixir of life, the universal solvent, H2O. Dr. Seth Darling explains all. I hope you'll stay tuned. A couple of years ago, there was a phrase that everybody was reciting. They still are. The phrase was, "Orange is the new black." Soon that metamorphosed into, "Black is the new black," which sounded even more hip and ironic. Since I stopped watching TV 25 years ago, I had no idea where the phrase came from. "Orange is the new black." You'd think the fashion business, but no, hardly a trace of orange on the racks. 20 minutes ago, I finally looked it up and found that the phrase is the title of a TV show on Netflix. A lady gets sent to federal prison where the season's must-have color is orange. Who knew? So, just as orange is the new black, so water may be the new oil. Here we're not talking about salad dressing, we're talking about international conflict. Many of the wars of the 20th century have been about, to a large extent, the control of oil. Small wars, like the civil war in Sudan, not to mention Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. And also big wars. A big reason that England and the U.S. entered what we now call World War I was to grab control of the oil of the Middle East. In World War II, why were Germany and Britain shooting at each other in the deserts of North Africa instead of moving all those tanks to Stalingrad? Three-letter word starts with O. Oil fights are not going to end, but in this century, water fights are going to become more and more common, and probably more and more vicious. There are alternatives to oil. Fresh water is even more vital than oil, and there is no alternative to it. The demand is growing very rapidly, and the supply cannot increase. Wars over water to drink will be a growing problem, but that's not the whole of it. The materials of civilization as we know it require huge amounts of water to manufacture. Generating electricity requires a staggering amount of fresh water. Modern agriculture requires a staggering amount of fresh water. For example, nearly 700 gallons of fresh water are needed to produce each gallon of cow's milk. Steel, plastic, clothing, you name it, we're talking many billions of gallons of water a day just in the United States. Fresh water only. Seawater won't work. Want some more bad news? Climate change is decreasing the water supply. When the glaciers finish melting, the Ganges River will be a dustbed, and the Indians are going to go on the warpath, so to speak. Today and next week, we'll hear all about it in a very interesting talk by a young scientist, Dr. Seth Darling, Ph.D. It's from him I got all of the information about water that I just recited. Darling is a postdoctoral fellow with the Argonne National Laboratory near Chicago. His approach is interdisciplinary. He combines chemistry, materials engineering, physics, biology, and a few other fields of science. He's obviously a very sharp guy and, mirabile dictu, a very good public speaker. Mirabile dictu is Latin. It means golly in academic jargon. Actually, Dr. Darling himself never uses the phrase. I just needed to remind everybody that he's not the only PhD in the room. I'm just kidding. Water is the new oil also is my phrase, not Darling's. I think. If all my listeners were as old as I am, I would have titled this show, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Water, but Were Always Afraid to Ask. But how many would get the joke? So, water is the new oil, it is. Speaking at the University of Chicago in May 2016, here is Dr. Seth Darling.
Water has also driven a number of revolutions. It was transoceanic sailing that globalized civilization. Water wheels launched the Industrial Revolution. Watt's steam engine revolutionized transportation and industry. Sanitation of our water system extended human lifetimes by decades. Great dams, like Hoover Dam pictured here, finally gave mankind control over the fickle precipitation of Mother Nature, limiting both flooding and droughts. That allowed food production to increase, while at the same time giving you hydroelectric electricity. That is one of the reasons that the United States rose as a global power. And intermodal shipping containers have revolutionized global commerce. About 90% of commerce occurs on the water in our oceans. Water also controls our weather. So water comes into our lives in so many central ways. Let me ask you a question to test your knowledge on water here. So we use a lot of water in this country. Who do you think is the largest withdrawer? Where does most of our water get withdrawn in this country? Anybody? Agriculture was what I was expecting you to say. That's where most of our water is used, but I chose my words carefully here. I said withdrawn. Power plants. Power plants in our country withdraw over 200 billion gallons of water a day. And that's used in part to boil that water by burning coal or natural gas or nuclear heat or whatever to make steam, to turn turbines and make electricity, but also for cooling of those power plants. And so they return a lot of that water back to the lake or river that it came from, so it's not used in the sense that it is in agriculture, but they do withdraw much more than we do for agriculture. So that's one intimate connection between water and energy, that we use so much water to make the energy that we all use. But you can flip that around, too, and say, where does most of our energy go? Well, it turns out that the biggest user of our electricity is actually water treatment, distribution, and use. So it goes both ways. Energy and water are so interconnected that there's a name for it. It's called the water-energy nexus. And Argonne National Laboratory is a Department of Energy laboratory, so you might ask, why are we talking about water? Here's a big reason why we're talking about water, because water and energy are inextricable. In fact, here's a report that you can grab from online if you've got nothing to do for a few hours that was just published recently, see, in 2014, that really highlighted a lot of these interconnections between energy and water. I've just mentioned a few here, but there are many, many more. Okay, so water is clearly important, but it's invisible. Water is actually hidden all around us, even in this room. Let me give you an example. If you take 683 gallons of water, you can grow 6 pounds of alfalfa hay. If you take those 6 pounds of alfalfa hay and you feed them into a machine that looks like that, it will give you 1 gallon of milk. So in that single gallon of milk sitting in your fridge are represented almost 700 gallons of water. It's not just milk. It's all of the food that we use. A single grape, not a bunch of grapes, one grape is about a third of a gallon of water. One walnut, almost 5 gallons. One potato, nearly 7. A cup of coffee, and this isn't a venti latte frappuccino, we're talking about just a cup of coffee with nothing in it, is 37 gallons. If you do make it a latte, it's going to go way up, because as I explained a moment ago, dairy has a lot of embedded water in it. A single Greek yogurt is about 90 gallons. And the biggest culprit here would be meat, especially beef, which represents, in the case of a hamburger, over 600 gallons of water. But it's not just food. It's also the materials that we use. Steel. To make steel, you need water. To make 1 pound of steel, which is not a very big piece of steel, it would take 11 gallons of water. And this is true of all the other materials that we use. Plastic, cement, cotton, paper, all of them take water to make. What that means is that the clothes that you're all wearing, the phone that's in your pocket, the car that you drove to get here, all of those things have within them virtual water. So globally, we don't move water from one part of the world to another in any appreciable amount because the scales of water that we use are ginormous. To give you an example of that, the Jardine Water Plant here outside of Chicago processes as much water in one day as the entire volume of petroleum we use in the United States in that day. So that's the type of scales we're talking about. So you're not going to move that type of volume from one point to another, and I'll talk more about that later. But we do move virtual water around because all of the goods that we're shipping around the earth have within them, as I just described, embedded water. And so there are folks who have looked at this and kind of tracked. There are countries that are net exporters of virtual water and countries that are net importers of virtual water. And perhaps it's not surprising when you see, for example, North Africa and the Middle East are net importers of virtual water. They're not bringing in water, but they're bringing in an awful lot of food, for example. And so we're moving a lot of water around, not all of which is sustainable water, and we're not policing this in any organized way. This is a policy problem that is going to have to be addressed going forward. Let me just give you one example. There's a company based in Saudi Arabia called Al Marai, which I'm told, I don't speak Arabic, but I'm told that means the pasture. There's no pasture in Saudi Arabia. The pasture in this case is in the American Southwest. So Al Marai is the largest vertically integrated dairy company in the world. And what they do is they extract groundwater in the Southwest. We'll get to groundwater a little bit later. And they use that to grow hay. And then they ship that hay to the dairy cows in the Mideast to make the dairy to use there. So they're actually moving massive amounts of groundwater, effectively, from the American Southwest, which is, as I'll describe, not sustainable, to another part of the world. These are things that we need to start paying much more attention to. So water is important, but in fact, it's becoming even more important as we go forward in time. So we don't have a shortage of water on Earth. There's an enormous amount of water on Earth, but unfortunately, the vast majority of it is in the oceans, salt water, which we can't use for much of anything in that form. So it's actually about 97% of the water on Earth is in our oceans, which translates to 350 quintillion some gallons. A lot of water. But you can't drink that stuff. You can't water your crops with it. You can't even put it through a power plant, in fact. The water that we all deal with is the fresh water, which represents less than 3% of the water on Earth. So how is this fresh water distributed, this less than 3% of the water? Well, there's the water that we see that, you know, evaporates, ends up in the clouds, comes down as rain and snow, and we see that in forms like Lake Michigan out there. That I would call renewable runoff. Some of that water is going to percolate down through the ground and form groundwater, aquifers. And as long as you withdraw that water at a slower pace than it's being replenished, it would be renewable. Of course, that's not what we're doing, though. In almost every case, when we start tapping these aquifers, we're withdrawing the water at a much faster rate than it's being replenished. And so in that sense, it's not truly renewable. There are other aquifers in the ground that are sometimes called fossil water, akin to fossil fuels. And it's not fossil in the sense like fossil fuels where it's made of fossilized organisms, but in the sense that it's been there for a really, really long time and is not being replenished at all. In some cases, hundreds of thousands of years, maybe even millions of years, some of these aquifers, when you tap those, that is a one-time use resource. An example of that, Libya. Libya built something called the Great Man-Made River, where they ran under the Sahara to bring fossil water for them to use for all the things we use water for. And they spent $32 billion U.S. dollars building that great man-made river, and the projections are that it will only last about 20 years. At that point, they've expended that resource. So how is this less than 3% of water distributed? Well, all that stuff we see is only actually about 0.3% of the less than 3% of the water on Earth. About 30% of that less than 3% is in that groundwater. And I'm assuming you guys can do the math and see that that doesn't total up to 100. Where is the rest of that fresh water? It's locked up in places where we can't get at it. Things like glaciers and the permafrost and so on. So the amount of water we're talking about that we all use is actually a tiny fraction of that massive amount of water on Earth. What's worse is that that resource is becoming even smaller. One of the reasons is because of climate change. So moment of self-promotion, that's a picture of a book that I wrote with a colleague at Argonne, How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate, which combats all of the myths that you hear out there from the denial or skeptic community. One of the effects of climate change is that glaciers are melting. All over the planet, glaciers are melting. That's been very well documented now. The reason that's a big concern is that glaciers like those in the Tibetan Plateau in the Himalayas, the annual melt from those glaciers is the source of most of the major river systems in Asia. So the Indus and the Ganges and the Yangtze and the Yellow, all those rivers, that's where they get their water from. So when those glaciers disappear, those rivers are going to dry up. And that water is the source of water for about 1.5 billion people on Earth and growing. So where are all those people going to get water when those glaciers are gone or when they've shrunk enough that there's not enough water there? I don't have an answer for you. There's another issue with climate disruption, which is that we're getting more severe droughts than we've ever witnessed before. So this is well known to folks who live in California now and all of us who buy the produce that is grown there. But other parts of the world, too. The drought that's in the Middle East is said to be the worst in 900 years. And people will tell you that that drought led to food shortages, which has led to a lot of the civil unrest that's in that part of the world right now. What's going on in Syria was in part fed by food shortages, leading to refugee crises and everything else. So we've got a serious supply problem with water. It's a tiny supply, and it's shrinking. What about demand? Well, bad news there, too. Turns out demand is skyrocketing for water because of population growth and development. We just start using more water. Because remember, it's not just bathing and brushing your teeth and whatever. Anything you use, remember, has water in it. So as people start to have more things, that means they need more water. So it's projected that over the next 35 years, by the year 2050, global demand will rise at least 55%. So we've got shrinking supply, growing demand for a resource that we depend on for almost everything in our life. So what does that mean? It means that just like in the previous century where oil conflicts governed our geopolitics, in this century it's going to be water. We are going to have water-based conflicts, which are going to shape our century. And this is already happening. The Aral Sea is all but dried up in Central Asia, so the Fergana Valley is no longer fertile in the way it once was, and all of those Central Asian countries are sniping with each other now about those limited resources that are left. Same is going on in intrastate conflict in India. Another example from South America, the Salala River that flows from Bolivia into Chile. It goes into the Atacama Desert there, one of the driest places on Earth, and they need it for their mining operations in the Atacama Desert, which is one of the foundations of the Chilean economy. But that they want those water resources, but the Bolivians need them too. And if the Bolivians take more of that water, less of it gets to Chile. And so there's conflict between them now. The Nile Basin has been a source of water-based conflict since, as I told you, the time of the pharaohs. But this is still true today. You have countries on the tail end of the Nile, like Egypt, that rely on the Nile. But those headwaters are in Ethiopia and Kenya. And so that continues to be a source of struggle. And we all are familiar with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A lot of folks don't realize, though, that a big piece of that conflict revolves around the limited water resources in that region. Those draft agreements that get written up once in a while to find a peaceful solution, a chunk of that paperwork is actually devoted to water. So water is surely the most important material in the world. But as I told you, water is invisible. And this is not good for us or for water. So why is water so invisible? I think a good explanation for that is that for a long time, at least in the developed world, we've been living in what I call the golden age of water. So what do I mean by the golden age of water? When you're in the Golden Age, you have three things all at the same time. You have water that is abundant, safe, and cheap. When you have all three of those, you kind of start ignoring water. It doesn't seem so precious or rare anymore. It leads to things like this. If you stayed at a Four Points hotel a few years ago, the little water bottle that was in your room came with a placard on it that said that. It's water. Of course it's free. They were trying to make fun of the hotels that charge you $5 for a bottle of water. But what they're really doing is they're tapping into something primal about our relationship with water. We feel like it should be free. Why would I pay for water? And this mentality of, well, water should be free, there's plenty of it out there and it's safe and whatever, leads us to do things like this. Here in America, we flush almost 6 billion gallons of perfectly fresh drinking water down the toilet every day, literally. This is because you have one pipe of water coming into your house, and that water is drinkable. And you use that same water to flush your toilet or to drink or to wash your clothes or to water your lawn or whatever else you're doing with water. Remember the Romans. They were the ancient Romans. They had a better idea. You don't need to use the same quality of water for every purpose. It's time for us to start rethinking that. So how else do we waste water these days? Well, a lot of this is invisible to us under the ground in our water infrastructure, all those water mains. So you don't see them because they're under the streets and sidewalks, but they're in terrible condition. Many of them were built, you know, a century ago, and they're falling apart. So we spend tons of energy and other resources getting water so it's drinkable, cleaning up all the junk that ends up in water, and pumping it out into those water mains. And then one in every 6 of those gallons of water is just lost to leaks in those pipes underground, because there are so many. Speaking of our infrastructure, I'll tell you how underfunded that problem is. We actually spend about as much buying bottled water in this country as we do maintaining our entire water infrastructure, all the treatment plants, all those water mains, all of it. This is something like a $1 trillion infrastructure need that we have, and we're vastly underspending. How else is water disrespected? This isn't true so much here in the United States, but when you look globally, about 80% of sewage is just discharged untreated back into waterways. You can imagine the problems that that leads to with disease. Hydraulic fracturing impacts our water in many different ways negatively. Agricultural runoff. We put all this fertilizer on our crops with nitrogen and phosphorus and so on, and then either from irrigation or precipitation, a bunch of it gets washed away, ends up in places like the Gulf of Mexico. You get big algal blooms and dead zones. Huge problem in our waterways today. Heavy metals. This is familiar to anyone in Flint, Michigan these days, or anyone who reads the news, but there are plenty of other ways that heavy metals get into our water. What's pictured here was is a river in Colorado where, you might remember, it was maybe a year or two ago, the EPA accidentally released a bunch of water from a mine that was heavily polluted with heavy metals, and that was the actual color. That's not a false color. That was the color of the river after all those metals ended up in there. We also have lots of pathogens in our water, thanks to, in part, that untreated sewage. Another interesting thing that ends up in our water are these guys, so-called micropollutants. You can take water from your tap and find pretty much all of these things in there, even after it's gone through the treatment plant. The amounts are tiny. They're not relevant necessarily to us, but they're in there. So we are all taking Prozac and birth control in every glass of water. Maybe that's a good thing. So again, these amounts are not high enough to affect us, but they do start affecting ecologies. There have been studies showing some fish species that are affected by those hormones and they're not reproducing properly anymore, for example. So this golden age of water is ending. And this is going to reshape how we all live. It's going to change how our food is raised, how our communities are organized, and in fact, how our entire economy functions. So in the golden age, we had abundant, cheap, and safe. And you're probably going to be able to get 2 out of 3 in most cases. You can have water that's abundant and cheap if you haven't spent any energy cleaning it up, but you're probably not going to want to drink that stuff. You can have water that's abundant and safe if you spend a fortune cleaning it, like the state-of-the-art desalination plant pictured here. Or you can have cheap and safe water, but just not enough of it. Think California drought right now. So all of those are going to be situations of water crisis, which certainly is going to be happening a lot in the future. But if you look around the world, water crisis is already happening in many places. So on the next slide, to me, is the scariest statistic I show in any talk that I give. This, every time I read it, is amazing to me. Every 90 seconds, a child somewhere dies because of a water-related disease. Every 90 seconds. Think about how many children will be dead by the time we walk out of this room. There's no reason for this to be happening in 2016. Millions of Indian girls and elsewhere, this is true in Africa and many other places too, are trapped by water. And what do I mean by that? They don't have water in their homes. They've got to go get water from some source, a well or otherwise, which on average is well over a mile away from their home. So what that means is all the water you have to use for everything, sanitation, washing your clothes, cooking, you name it, whatever you're going to use water for, every drop needs to be carried on their head from that site over a mile away. That takes so long to do that every day, they don't go to school. They never get to enter the economy and participate like their male siblings. This is another thing that needs to change. So you may have heard the famous quote, all politics is local. I like to say, all water is local. So I told you we can't move water easily from one region to another. And water needs vary dramatically as you look around the world because of precipitation and population and other things. But even if a water-poor region of the world wanted to buy water from us here, from our Great Lakes, we can't get it to them. You can't get enough water from Lake Michigan to Haiti or somewhere else where they would want water because you just can't move enough. So why don't we have these water pipelines to try and make it more equitable, the distribution of water? So one of the reasons, a very big reason, is the volumes involved, as I described earlier. You'd have to move a ridiculous amount of water, probably not even feasible to move that type of water over really large distances.
Scientist Dr. Seth Darling with part one of a very interesting talk about another natural resource we had better get serious about conserving. Dale Lehman of station WZRD in Chicago made available the original recording, which I have condensed a bit. Thanks to Dale. And thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll tune in again for part two of Darling's talk next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is the Taylor Report, CIUT at 9.5 FM, and like all conscientious Canadians, we're trying to figure out, understand who our foreign minister and the prime minister and the policies of the country. On March the 6th, there was a press conference to announce that more troops were going to be sent to Ukraine as a show of solidarity. And there's been a debate about this, whether this is actually a good idea. But it was the foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, was there with our defense minister, and they thought it was – said they'd be doing it. And there were some questions, and one of the questions had to do – and by the way, here's one place I am unable to help you. I don't know who asked the question, but it was a reference to the fact that there were writers – people are calling them bloggers, but, I mean, we have some very distinguished writers talking about Canadian foreign policy, situation in Ukraine, Poland, Russia, and the general crisis there, troubling developments. And so there is good – there's plenty of interest and plenty of discussion and most – and some of it edifying. So along the way, it was a – said that Chrystia Freeland's grandfather has been the editor of a paper that collaborated with the Nazis, the Ukrainian paper. And so they wanted her comment. And her comment was that you had to be aware of Russian disinformation and we should all be on our toes. And so I'm really glad that this subject comes up because we've heard this expression. It was introduced to us, by the way, by Hillary Clinton and Obama. They're the first ones to say false news is, you know. So we've all been told, we've been McCarthyized, be on the lookout for false news. Don't want any false news to creep up behind you, you know, and bite you. And so she said that there was some false, disinformation. And that was end of the discussion. And bless his heart, a writer at the Ottawa Citizen, Mr. Pugliese, looked into it and said, well, in fact, this was the line that she used was disinformation. However, he said her grandfather was in fact editor of a Nazi collaborating paper. Now look, and right away the game starts to roll the other direction. This becomes spin time. Incidentally, for 5 days the Toronto Star fell silent. They had nothing to say about any of this. It just like, and they went to the headquarters, I guess. And everybody sat on their hands and waited for leadership to give them a tip which way we're going to go with this story. Because what do you do? And and when they did decide to say something, they said, well, what is this? We're talking about a grandfather. How is this relevant? This got nothing to do with it. She's not responsible for anything her grandfather did. And it's an old story. I think that in fairness to Chrystia Freeland, we have to point out to the Star, they have no business speaking in her place. And some people have referred to her uncle, who is a scholar. They said he wrote an article, and the Star referred to this, saying, so it's old news. He wrote in 1996 that indeed Mr. Chomiak, Michael Chomiak, had been an editor of a Nazi collaborating paper published in Krakow, where you would expect to find a Ukrainian newspaper, Krakow, Poland, and that therefore they said she knew. Well, she didn't say she knew. She has yet to say she knows anything about this. And if you say her uncle wrote this article in 96, that's good for him. But that doesn't address what she says she knew. And in 2015, she said what she knew. This is 2015 is not 1996. That's some years later. She said, in 1939, my grandparents fled Ukraine and eventually came to Canada. The record shows that in 1939, and she said, by the way, at the time of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, because the Russians, she said, this is 2015, Chrystia Freeland writing. She said, my blah, blah, 2015. And she said, because of Hitler-Stalin Pact. Well, in 1939, her grandfather went to work for Hitler. He apparently didn't go to work for Stalin. Apparently, he went to work for Hitler. That was his choice, and it's not her choice. That was his choice. And so that's what happened in 1939. Now, Mr. Pugliese, Ottawa citizen, has written clearly and unequivocally that and pointed out that she has not ever acknowledged that as a fact. She's never acknowledged that he was a collaborator. And that's of interest. And as he points out, and others do, the issue is not about him. It's her awareness of the facts, which seem clear. Maybe she should just phone her uncle. But anyhow, her awareness of the facts has not come to any conclusion about it. The obvious, many of us know people I bet I have some relatives. I don't know. But if I find them, I would definitely say he was a bad guy and nothing to do with me. And I might even say I personally like him. All that's doable. That's all understandable. If you're a child, what's that got to do with you? And somebody's nice to you on the block, and then you find out later he was a Nazi collaborator, you notice that. But if you say nothing, and indeed if you say he's a good guy, and that if you say he fled when he didn't fled, actually, no, the record shows something else, as I said. In 1939, he went to work in Krakow at a paper that had and this is for her to clarify. If she wants to debate it, that's all debated. But according to the Los Angeles Holocaust Museum, they took over the premises. The Nazis did. By the way, the Star doesn't make that clear. They say he was working for a Ukrainian paper. No, it was a Nazi paper. Ukrainians didn't put up the money for that. As a matter of fact, nobody put up the money for it. They stole it. It was stolen from an individual whose name I will turn to here at some point, but a Jewish citizen of Poland whose printing press it was and whose offices they were. They took that over. The word they used for that was Aryanized. They Aryanized it. And Mr. Chumiak became the editor. The individual who's lost his printing press and his property also lost his life. He was taken to Belzec, where he was murdered. That's what we're told is the historical record. I'm open to hearing any other contrary details, but Ms. Freeland is being defended passionately by a whole bunch of people who are morally bankrupt, who don't care about these historical details. Again, all she has to say is he did that, and I didn't do it, and I didn't approve of it, and I'm sorry to learn that my grandfather was one of those. That she has not said, and the Toronto Star is presuming to speak for her. For all I know, she thinks Grandpa was right. That also is her right, if that's what she wants to say. By the way, the owner of the paper, Moshe Kafner, brings up another issue in my mind. The Star also decided to dip us all in mud in an article by a guy named Wells, in which he said, war is hell. Chrystia Freeland has nothing to apologize for, nothing to be ashamed of. Well, war was hell for Moshe Kafner. They took his property. They Aryanized it, gave it over to Jew baiters, and then they killed him. Mr. Wells, that would be called hell. And Michael Chomiak got a job, got a salary, and a car. He had a living, and he stayed with it. Because when the Germans were defeated, they moved west. They packed up, and they took Mr. Chomiak with them. And he opened his paper again in Vienna, where he went on publishing. And he was celebrating, as his, you know, as his prerogative, he was supporting the Germans in their fight to have an Aryan-dominated Earth. And he stayed with them until they were defeated. That's what we know. So this is at variance with Mrs. Freeland's story, as of this date. To this date, she has never said any of these things. All she said was he fled in 39. That doesn't appear to be accurate. To go back to Mr. Pugliese, who's the most honorable, in my opinion, clear journalist and courageous, too, problem here is disinformation and false news. All of it comes to the door of our foreign minister, and since she only serves our prime minister, it's the prime minister's responsibility, not hers. She serves only because he wants her to serve. But I think we have a little, I'd say, Ottawa, we have a problem. Until that's addressed, I don't see, how can anybody give anybody a pass? And just for the record, you have to remember, Ukraine is in a crisis. There are armies around. There is violence today, and this is part of Europe. And so when you have violence in Europe, missiles, airplanes, bombs, it's time to pay attention, close attention. And we have in Kyiv a government which they just named a street after a gentleman named Stepan Bandera. Now, again, her writings, I know that Chrystia Freeland seems to have a different view of Mr. Bandera than most of us. And here, by the way, let's introduce this magic formula which can cure all ills, according to witch doctors in New York and Washington, pro-Russia. This is a question of people who are pro-Russia. I can guarantee you I wouldn't know how to be pro-Russia. I'm definitely not anti-Russia. But there's another party to this quarrel that needs to be respected, and that's Poland. Now, according to Poland, Mr. Bandera is a criminal, and this is a dangerous and offensive thing. The name of the street had been Moscow, so they thought it would be a good joke and name it after Mr. Bandera, who allied himself with the Nazis. That's really not questioned. He did. If you were to read Chrystia Freeland, she has a kind of a way of a broad stroke method of saying, well, he was both anti-Soviet, anti-Nazi. He just seemed to be always with the Nazis. Let's just put it that way. But Poland has been asking about this. And today's headline, if you missed it, I think it's Associated Press. Am I right, Phil? Associated Press says that the Polish authorities are asking Americans to turn over a gentleman who served with the Ukrainian self-defense group with an SS attachment who slaughtered villagers in Poland. And so this is as much – if you want to talk about being the foreign minister and balance and diplomacy, you better be careful. And that's why it seems dubious that we have someone who is rather passionate on the part of and toward one group of people. The Poles actually come into this first, before Russians and before others, because it was setting up of these papers in Krakow with someone who had the view of Poles and Russians that Mr. Chomiak had. That's why the minister, in my opinion, has to say something. Let's talk about the sites. And incidentally, Phil, you have it here. I want to make sure we mention we have a wonderful broadsheet called Frank, right? It's no longer broadsheet.
It's not a broadsheet. It's a website.
Yeah, I know. Centuries ago, we had a thing called a broadsheet. Yeah. So I enjoy saying broadsheet. Yeah. But it's yes, it's a website called Frank, and it tends to be Frank. And they have a quote from Mr. Chomiak's paper. By the way, Toronto Star hasn't seen – they say, well, come on. He wrote stuff, bad stuff. And okay, give us an idea, Phil, what some of the bad stuff
this is
was
the November 6th, 1941 issue of Kravizsky Visti, which is the paper edited by Mr. Chomiak. It ecstatically describes how much better Kiev is without Jews. Quote, "There is not a single one left in Kiev today. While there were 350,000 Jews under the Bolsheviks," the newspaper wrote, gloating that the Jews, quote, "got their comeuppance," unquote. Well, those are the words that were edited by Christy Freeland's grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah. And now I have a point to pick with her uncle. He likes to say, oh, well, he didn't really have the final say. That's right. The Nazis had the final say. And he was on the payroll. And he was the editor. He's the editor of that paper. That's what was written. And again, that's found at the Los Angeles Memorial, Holocaust Memorial.
Holocaust Museum, yeah.
And on this thing of it, well, did she know about Grandpa? Well, I'm told she's an intellectual. I'm told that she's a scholar. I'm told she knows how to write a book. Most people do that kind of stuff. Kind of, if they have a grandfather who edited a prominent Ukrainian paper, but he never hid that fact, then you would think that she would have said, "What did Grandpa write?" And but apparently, Mr. Himka claims he didn't know until his father-in-law. That was, by the way, the Chomiak's son-in-law, Mr. Himka. I'm sure Chomiak doesn't appreciate Mr. Himka, but his spirit does. The characterization of editor or publisher, you know, go down to the Star and find out how it works. They're all pretty chummy. They don't really hate each other. They're all kind of on the same page and same paychecks and that kind of thing. So, yes, and again, many people were attacked. We were attacked. I don't know if Christian Freeland knows this, but actually we were at war with Hitler and her grandfather's friends. And we didn't actually – just because he said, oh, I killed Russians, those who are our allies. You have to look it up. You're probably a scholar. You could probably take some time out.
Well, you know that one of our colleagues has unearthed a copy of a front page, or I should say a picture of a front page of Kravizsky Visti celebrating the Germans' victory at Dieppe. Well, of course, the Germans' victory at Dieppe involved killing about 1,000 Canadians and taking another couple thousand prisoner, right?
Yeah.
And again, this was Christie's grandfather celebrating.
Well, and the sinking of ships with thousands of lives lost. Incidentally, that's exactly what you'd expect and blah, blah. And it's not on her, provided we hear from her. But actually, what we really have is a crisis of a silent minister and a silent prime minister, because all they have to do is come clean about this. I mean, make up their minds. If you want to go hard line, and I think they're tempted to do it, which is double down and say, yes, we like Mr. Bandera too, because we've been there with Victoria Nuland. Who chose the first Ukrainian government after what they call the revolution. If you want to know, all this flows back to that decision to, instead of having a negotiated peaceful resolution of the matter, which Poland, by the way, helped midwife, there was an agreement for a peaceful resolution of the conflict in Ukraine. The Star presumes to write about Ukraine like it's one thing. It's been two things ever since the Maidan exercise. It's been more than at least two, because you took away a mechanism to resolve it through elections. Instead, one side took power, and they began to cleanse the other side and to come out with diktat. It's going to be this way. That's exactly where the crisis started. And again, who was the main cause of that? That was a U.S. State Department official, Victoria Nuland, who we all remember. She said, Yats is the guy. She didn't remember how to say Yatsenyuk. She called him Yats because he was in her hip pocket. By the way, speaking of being in hip pockets, Yats recently, 6 months ago, was bodily removed from the Ukrainian parliament by a member of the parliament who walked up to him as he was frozen in place. I think his lips were moving, but I didn't hear his sound. And the member picked him up and walked out of the room with him. And Yats heroically remained silent and looked like a mannequin. We haven't seen him since. There's a rumor that he's here, by the way, that he might be living in Canada, but we're not going to press them on that. They can whatever they do with Yats is their business. But Victoria Nuland wanted Yats to run the country, so she put him in power. She encouraged them to break law, the Ukrainian law, which wasn't – and when you do that, you alienate people. And the star doesn't – the star would have you believe there's just one Ukraine. But it's clearly a country – always has been since its departure from the Soviet Union and even before. Always difficult place because of the composition of the demographic composition of the country. That's just a fact. And you cannot just call it Ukraine and be describing anything. That's a very unhelpful way to talk about it. And with other people who've chimed in, who I think I'm really glad they did, Mr. Paul Grode of the Canadian Ukrainian Organization immediately called it false news and disinformation to raise the matter. He didn't then go to give us his opinion of the grandfather who had been editing a Nazi paper, because it's impolite for us to ask him to do that. And then the Ukrainian ambassador said it was a case of fake news. And he said, we know all about this, these Russian tricks, and you can come to us. I'd rather not, actually, because it wasn't fake, you see. So the Ukrainian ambassador and Mr. Grode are the ones who are speaking fake news. If they're going to say that in 1939, Mr. Chomyak fled because of the Hitler-Stalin pact, that would not be accurate. Mr. Chomyak got a job in Krakow, putting out paper. There are other places. And again, I'll call out, please read Pugliese, the Ottawa Citizen. He makes the case very clear. And that's the only place where any of us can take our stand. Let her now tell us why she said in 2015 that her grandfather, the swell guy, freedom lover, and he fled. That's not what he did. And she has and as Pugliese says, she's been silent. So that's where the problem is. It's not with us hating Grandpa. I, by the way, am not particularly enthusiastic about these things of hunting people into their 90th year, et cetera. But I am for clarifying the record. Incidentally, in order to have peace – I mean, that's how you ended up with peace at the end of World War II. There were plenty of Nazi collaborators, and we didn't go and kill them. Some were, but most were not, because people want peace. They want to say, look, let's just end this, and here will be the law, and these will be the rules, and then everybody says, okay, then you proceed. But you can't have everything going at once. And since she has an enthusiasm, or so far expressed in for this matter of the question of Bandera, who is a criminal to the Poles, the Polish government, it behooves the Canadian government to be clear about this, because when we do speak of Grandpa, it's kind of important to remember that today in Kiev, Grandpa's friends are all being honored. Grandpa's friends have political power, political positions, and they're certainly lauded. They are. And if she would like to add Grandpa to the list, I think that's fine. Just tell us, so we all know, that she would like to have a plaque put up to Grandpa. I'm sure that they would be happy to do it. But that's why it's relevant, because our government has been talking about these guys like it's an exercise in Greek democracy. Hasn't been that. And instead, World War II criminals are being celebrated, and there are, you like torch marches? They have a lot of torch marches. and they have brigades named after the old groups, and they march through the streets and say a bunch of people should be out of here and the others get to stay. This is going, moving across Europe as a problem. So there's a couple of sites, probably the one that drives everybody the maddest. You mentioned it was Frank, right?
Frank, yes.
Frank Magazine. And then there is johnhelmer.org. They're really on Helmer's case because Helmer's one of the people who did this.
And he evidently was a colleague of hers once in the press. They were in Moscow.
They worked together.
They worked together, yeah.
My guess is that he's as good a journalist. At this point, he seems to be a slightly better journalist than she is, even though she worked for snootier people. But and another – we got to get our – we're going to be revisiting what happened in World War II because people seem to have forgotten. And I want to also point out that 1.5 million Ukrainians died fighting Hitler. 1.5 million fighting. I'm not talking about just standing on a street corner. They were in combat against Hitler. Mr. Chomiak wasn't one of them. But when we talk about them, there's this tendency to think that they were all like Mr. Chomiak. That is way wrong. They always – his ideology, of which we're not told anything except that he was able to get a job with the Nazis. I wonder – I'd like to have been there for the interview, wouldn't you? I guess it was – you know, you think you can have – oh, yeah, I can do that. Anyway, but 1.5 million lost their lives fighting Hitler. He wasn't with them. He was – so in that sense, he was – you probably by them would have been regarded as something – what's the word? Traitor, I suspect, not as a patriot. This idea you're a patriot because you say, I want Ukrainian independence – the word independence has got to be a little – has to be fleshed out. What do you mean? Where's the capital going to be? What language are we going to speak? You know, that – independence is a nice word, like freedom. Yeah, very nice word. And he read – by the way, he worked under somebody – look up this name. Emil Gassner was his boss. And he was – there's a picture of Mr. Chomiak with Emil Gassner. And I'm sure that, by the way, it's probably a revelation to our foreign minister, but she would just explain to us who's in the picture, what's going on there, help out.
Gassner was the press boss for the area of Poland where this newspaper was. He was on the staff of the SS.
Hmm. Yeah. That's the way the ball bounces. Yes. She says that they're trying to destabilize Western democracies. If they're using the truth, Ms. Freeland, that truth is never an enemy of democracy. So somebody isn't better clarify this. The title of our little item here would be, and we will return to it, it's called The Long Will the Bitter Morsel Be Chewed, a Ukrainian proverb. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're pro-Poland. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Judy Collins.
Later on, we want bread, but we want roses too. The Lawrence, Massachusetts textile strike of 1912.
And now, women and immigrants from unity marches to preventing business as usual.
With Nelson Lichtenstein, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and director of the Center for Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy.
And we bid you a belated day without immigrants and a day without women, International Women's Day strike. Nelson.
Hello there. Glad to be with you.
Well, I can't think of anybody better to put in perspective the issue of the strike. Now, both the day without immigrants and International Women's Day was also posited as a one-day strike. And I was elated to see us moving from the general protest rally, which was of enormous significance and importance, and they all have been since Trump took office. But can you put in perspective for us, historical perspective, and the significance of beginning to look at the issue of strikes as a manner of protest? And
yes,
thank you for joining us.
The thing today is that while the strike, as it was sort of codified, in the years since the 30s and into the today, that traditional trade unions conduct, is really in abeyance very much. They don't take place very much, and they sometimes win, but sometimes they don't. However, at the same time, all sorts of people who are not in unions and not in never done anything before of that sort are talking about a strike, even if they don't quite understand the meaning of it. And I've been to some meetings where that's the case, and I think that's terrific, because it indicates they want to do something which is more than just traditional party politics, or also more than the massive demonstrations, which are very good and which we've had, and they're more than that. What I have been arguing for some time now is that the tradition that was in the 19th century and really up through the middle of the 20th century was the word march or the word demonstration was practically synonymous with the word strike. That is, when you had from the antebellum era, the Lowell Mills to the to the Knights of Labor and on into the CIO and the Industrial Union period, when labor or other groups as well, immigrants as well, had a march down the street or a demonstration. It was on a weekday typically, and it closed down the workplaces. That tradition changed really in the 60s in the student movement, and when we started having anti-war marches and later on other kinds of demonstrations on Saturdays. Now that was, there were good reasons for that. I mean, lots of people, you get out and all sorts of things, and they were all usually on Saturdays. The thing that I was inspired by was 11 years ago when we, with the first Day Without Immigrants, and there was a controversy about it. That is this was 2006. There was an anti-immigration bill in Congress, and various sort of unions and Latino labor, Latino radio stations, sort of in California and elsewhere, said, "Let's have a day without immigrants." And there was a lot of controversy about it. Wait a minute! You're going to be hurting, people going without a day without work. Get money. What if they get penalized by their employer? And maybe we shouldn't do this. Anyway, it was a controversy, but it took place. I think it was a Wednesday, and it was a magnificent success. And what was remarkable was that employers who would otherwise be extremely hostile to unions or other kinds of organizations just sort of shut down because they could see the power of this thing. And it was very successful. And I think that can be replicated and it is being replicated today. I think there's potential for that. I see potential for that. I'll explain that in a bit if you'd like for me to do that.
Yeah, if you could expand on that and also how this relates to a general strike.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. I think the reason for doing this is not just to it's that to have what's happened with demonstrations on Saturdays, people come together, it then dissipates afterwards. There's no kind of permanent organization. But if you're going to shut down workplaces, you need both organization beforehand and afterward, not necessarily a traditional union, but you need it. And so I think what's possible these days, and we've seen hints of it, for example, when the president of Uber, CEO, was sort of pressured to stay off of the Trump's board, and recently at a Walt Disney meeting, there was a lot of criticism of the president of Walt Disney to get out. This pressure did not come from some traditional union. It came from people, working in maybe some were managers. And I think it's possible today that you could have what would be a kind of general strike. There really be sectorial strikes. That is, you could have, and the issue is immigration, which affects the workplace, and many places. So, for example, one day you could have, Hollywood studios shut down. I mean, and that'd be sort of with a complicit agreement of some of the managers. Or another day, Silicon Valley are part of it. Or another day, some hospital or a university. And I think that that as ICE, becomes more active and begins to pick up people who people know about, I think this is quite possible. So it's kind of a, it's not like the kind of general strike that Luxembourg, talked about 100 years ago, where the whole country shuts down permanently. But they're sort of one day demonstration strikes in key industries, which indicate that the sort of the body politic is against what Trump is seeking to do.
Well, how does this relate to general strikes as they occur in Europe and also the general strikes that happened in the U.S. in the 30s and the 40s?
Yeah, well, okay, there was a difference here. The strikes that occurred in, like, the San Francisco general strike or Oakland, these were always, almost always, they were called by workers' unions when the state used the police or the National Guard to escort strike breakers either into the ports or into some building or some factory. It was a protest against the state, but for use of the police. The strikes today, it's not specifically the police are going to, are being used to escort strike breakers, but it is a kind of strike against the use of the police power as I would foresee it, most likely event would be in terms of police power to round up undocumented immigrants. Or another example of this would be, going back to the 19th century, the Fugitive Slave Law. When the Fugitive Slave Law was put into effect in 1850, citizens of Boston and Concord and upstate New York, when the slave catchers came to pick up the slaves, they, in the streets, and they prevented them, and they weren't, they called them mobs or demonstrations, but people left work. And so really that, I think, is an historical analogy as well.
One of the exciting things that happened in this city occurred in 2006 on May Day in Union Square, where we saw immigrants taking the lead, 100,000 strong in Union Square, who stayed away from work. And very impressive, although not certainly in the numbers, but not insignificant, event occurred recently in New York, where the Yemenis in particular, but other Muslim bodega shopkeepers, etc., forced the stores to close. And indeed, even many of the store owners voluntarily closed them in acknowledgement of the power of these groups of workers who we don't necessarily think of in the traditional way that we thought of unions. And as a matter of fact, organized unions haven't been here.
Right. And I would extend that. Yes, that idea that, and I wrote some other pieces about this, that the American left was built by immigrants, and it will be built again by immigrants. I mean, you can go back to the Irish Fenians, the German anarchists, the Jewish Bundists, Italian anarchists, and of course the recently the Latinos for several decades. The core of the American left has been immigrants, and for many good reasons, because they feel marginal, and because they feel threatened, and because sometimes back in the homeland they were revolutionaries, and that's why they came here. And I think that's we can see it in front of our eyes today.
You know, one of the things that I was particularly entranced by in many ways in your article, which is how immigrants make the American left and Americans built it, right, and are going to do it again. And one of the things you pointed out is you look at Chicago and you kind of meld together what happened with the 1955 murder of Emmett Till. Yeah, and I wonder if you can, and before that you were speaking about the Puerto Rican nationalists. So take us to those places and give us a sense of the power that's there.
I consider African Americans who left the South and went to the North, I consider them immigrants. And in fact, the Great Migration, which began in World War One, and and many of they went to Chicago and other great big cities in the North. And so they became political, and they became really a part of the core of the civil rights movement. And so Emmett Till, the famous brutal murder of a young boy in Mississippi in 1955. I mean, this had been happening, all the time. This was nothing unusual about Emmett Till's murder. That had been going on. But when this happened, though, he was from Chicago. His family was connected to the packing house workers, to the NAACP. The Communist Party was a largely black organization still vital in Chicago. And all of these groups mobilized, and including the congressman, Hayes, who had come out of the packing house workers, and he actually went right down to Mississippi and sat in the courtroom, and that's why there was so much publicity, sitting there watching the trial. And so the Emmett Till became a national issue and became a kind of landmark moment for the civil rights movement because of the power now of these immigrants from the South to one and two and three generations who were organized in the North. And that's exactly what's happening today in California and New York and Chicago with Latinos and other immigrants. They're politically organizing themselves, and their weight is being felt, and it'll be felt even more.
Where do you see the role of labor and the evolution of these protests, especially since the Women's March? Do the women strike?
I mean, I think the labor is taking. I mean, some of the SEIU locals are taking part of the lead in I think it will be a May Day set of demonstrations and strikes on a weekday. I think the labor movement, I mean, which is today a plurality of all those, you know, in the unions are either women or people of color or immigrants. It has to be involved in order to reestablish its legitimacy and to for people to understand that the labor movement is a liberation movement. I mean, it began that way, and it has to be seen that way once again, because as simply a collective bargaining movement, it won't attract the power it needs. It's a movement of democracy and liberation, and that is essential. So, and therefore, I'm critical of those unions that are seeking to form, you know, to have some sort of deal with Trump, you know, for some for jobs. This is a very short-sighted, I think.
So two additional questions, Nelson, and that is, are we beginning to see the falling away of the organized labor, the AFL-CIO, who doesn't seem to have been present in any momentous form in this, and the real advent of workers' centers through immigrant workers and so on? That's one part of it, the significance. And for those people who don't really understand in any event, because they weren't enculturated with that, the issue of strikes. What does that mean to building a real resistance and a transformative power paradigm, which is certainly what we need, lest we fall right back into the hands of the Democratic Party liberals?
Yeah. No, I'll start with the second part of that question first. I agree. That's interesting. I think there's a moment here. As I say, I'm struck just anecdotally, maybe perhaps, by people want to have a strike. They don't even know what it is exactly, but they know that they want to do something. And that's why I think that the separation, the division between demonstrations like on a Saturday and strikes at work, that this has to be bridged, and it can be done by you know, if you're going to go out on a weekday, then you're going to have to think about work, and then you've got to talk to your fellow mates at work, and it's a kind of beginning of a kind of self-organization. So I think that we need to take advantage of that impulse to do something more dramatically than say the Democratic Party. I agree with you on that. On the question of labor itself, I mean, I think that one thing that Trump's done that's bad has been to reanimate this archaic view of labor as, like, you know, white male steel workers and coal miners. I mean, they aren't anywhere. That's not what labor is anymore. But he kind of reanimated that idea, and we, you know, the fact is the labor movement in popular understanding has to be understood as the home health care workers and the nurses and the maids and janitors. This is what the labor movement is today, and I do think that wing of it and much of it's in the SEIU. That SEIU has problems, but I think there is they understand that, and many of their members are immigrants or no immigrants. So I think that can be part of this larger movement that's afoot here.
Well, we need to have you back to explore this even more conclusively, and I do strongly recommend the article which was put out by Portside, which are really no more Saturday marches, but the particular one, how immigrants built the American left and can build it again. And we have been speaking with Nelson Lichtenstein, who teaches history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he directs the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. Promise to come back?
Yes, indeed.
Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching.
At the turn of the century, America was rapidly becoming an industrial society. Nearly 30 million immigrants had risked the long trip to the New World with dreams of a better life. Many found their way to the textile mills of New England, where the opportunity was work with low wages, long hours, and dangerous working conditions. The factory system ushered in new demands for efficiency and control.
I regard my people just as I regard my machinery.
Discrimination in the mills was widespread. Recruiting wagons, known as slavers, sought out young women and children who they could pay half as much as men. A family industry, they called it.
I used to go to school, and then a man came by to my house and asked my father why I didn't go to work. The man said, "You give me $4, and I will make papers come from the old country which say she is 14. I went to work, and in about 2 weeks got hurt in my head. The machine pulled my scalp off. I was in the hospital 7 months.
One out of every three mill workers died before the age of 25. Unions gained popularity among workers seeking better working conditions. The American Federation of Labor had won an eight-hour day for thousands of craft workers. But unskilled textile workers remained unorganized. In 1911, the Massachusetts state legislature reduced the working week from 56 to 54 hours. Unwilling to let workers benefit, Lawrence's American Woolen Company, the world's largest textile plant, cut workers' wages. On January 12, 1912, when workers received their paychecks, cries of short pay rang throughout the mill. 14,000 workers poured into the streets.
Starve working!
In 2 weeks, 25,000 workers from 11 mills had joined the strike. The city of Lawrence sounded a riot call. The workers had shut down the largest mills in the world. Mill owners kept their machines running, although no cloth was being woven, in an attempt to deceive the strikers. Carrying banners that read bread and roses, the strikers expressed their demand for livable wages, bread, but also for dignity and respect, for roses in their lives. The Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, sent nationally known labor leaders to organize the strike. They formed strike committees, representing workers of 30 nationalities, held parades, and put up picket lines. Labeled anarchists, agitators, and fomenters of violence by the press, the strike leaders warned the unarmed workers not to resort to violence. Wobbly leader Bill Haywood.
They cannot weave cloth with bayonets. By all means, make this strike as peaceful as possible. All the blood spilled will be your blood.
Company guards sprayed workers in picket lines with freezing cold water from high-pressure hoses. The city of Lawrence called in the state militia, and on January 29th, police and troopers opened fire on a crowd of strikers, killing a young woman striker named Anna Lopeza. As resources diminished, the children of strikers were sent to stay with supporters in other cities. The children's pilgrimage drew national sympathy to the Lawrence strikers. The mill owners were outraged. On the morning of February 24th, 40 children gathered at the railroad station with their families. Without warning, club-wielding police attacked the parents and children. The nation reacted with horror.
Every right supposedly guaranteed under the Constitution has been ruthlessly taken from the industrial slaves of Lawrence.
I would rather never again wear a thread of woolen than know my garments had been woven at the cost of such misery as I have seen.
In response to national outrage, President Taft ordered an investigation. Many strikers, including a delegation of 16 children, testified before Congress about working conditions in the mills. With public support on their side, the strike committee made a final appeal. On March 12th, 3 months after workers had walked off their jobs, the American Woolen Company, speaking for all Lawrence Mills, surrendered. 2 days later, 25,000 men, women, and children strikers gathered on the Lawrence Common and voted on the settlement. The workers had won wage increases, overtime pay, and rules against discrimination.
You have demonstrated the common interest of the working class. In bringing all nationalities together, you have won the most single victory of any body of organized workers in the world.
Though the victory was an example to textile workers in all of New England, the dream of one big union was short-lived. It would be another quarter of a century before industrial workers would form a union strong enough to win lasting gains.
Has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
If you can't use a bathroom, you can't participate in public life, and that's really what's at the center of this.
In the final analysis, it's the point to rub the power structure the wrong way and to sort of chafe the status quo so that things change. And if the immediate community gets rubbed the wrong way too, that's simply part of how history moves.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon.
There's new hope for Northern Ireland marriage equality, U.S. Supremes sidestep trans teen toilet rights, and the queer historian harmonizes street politics and the status quo. Their stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending March 11th, 2017. The door to marriage equality for Northern Ireland's gay and lesbian couples may have opened a bit wider. The ruling Democratic Unionist Party has used a parliamentary procedure known as a petition of concern to block even a debate on the issue in the unicameral Legislative Assembly for several years. The DUP needed a minimum of 30 seats in the chamber to continue to do that. But their recent shellacking in national elections by the left-leaning Sinn Féin party, which picked up 27 seats, left the former ruling party with only 28 members of the Legislative Assembly. The still-to-be-formed Northern Ireland Executive is the administrative branch of the Legislative Assembly. Claire Moore, a spokesperson for the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, told a press conference in Belfast this week, organized by the Love Equity Coalition, that a majority of MLA's newly reconstituted assembly now support opening civil marriage to same-gender couples. Any new executive, Moore said, must be willing to be a government for all the people of Northern Ireland. The will of the people must be respected. The Belfast Telegraph reported late this week, however, that the minority Ulster Unionist and traditional Unionist voice parties, whose policies define civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual, could support the DUP to achieve that 30-vote majority needed to pass a petition of concern to block discussion of the issue again. Northern Ireland is the last holdout in the British Isles to enact marriage equality. Stay tuned.
Meanwhile, the organizers of Boston's annual St. Patrick's Day parade gave an LGBT veterans group the okay to march in the parade in a Twitter message late in the evening of March 10th. That followed a firestorm after OutVets was denied entry earlier in the week because of its rainbow banners. Several political leaders, including Mayor Marty Walsh and Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, had vowed not to participate if the LGBT group couldn't. A statement by the organizing South Boston Allied War Veterans Council, which is made up of representatives from several South Boston American Legion and Veterans of Foreign Wars posts, first insisted that the council is accepting of all people and organizations, but it will not permit messages that conflict with the overall theme of the parade. It wasn't clear if the subsequent March 10th invitation to OutVets to participate included being allowed to march under their rainbow banners. According to the Boston Globe, the council later clarified that the OutVets invitation was unconditional, and the group then announced that it would indeed proudly march in the March 19th parade. OutVets marched peacefully under rainbow banners in 2015 and 2016 without incident. The group's executive director, Brian Bishop, said his first reaction to this year's rainbow banner ban was, "You gotta be kidding me. This is not a political issue," Bishop said of marching in the nation's second-largest St. Patrick's Day parade behind New York's, calling it an issue of discrimination against those who served. New York St. Patrick's Day parade organizers allowed a few self-identified LGBT groups to march there for the first time last year.
Elsewhere, a tribunal for minors in Florence this week recognized the British and U.S. adoptions by two different same-gender couples as legal in Italy. Among other benefits, the decision allows the Italian citizenship of the parents to be passed on to their children. The court wrote that if parental recognition were to be denied, this would result in a legal uncertainty that would negatively affect the children's development of personal identity. Nikki Vendola, a gay politician who had a child with his partner via a surrogate in the United States, told reporters that it's another step forward for the recognition of the rights of rainbow families. Two fathers and two adopted children are a family, he said. Period. Surrogacy is illegal in Italy. The country's high court last year made it easier for gay men and lesbians to adopt a partner's biological child. Observers believe that decision set the stage for a court in the Italian city of Trento to recently allow two gay dads to both be listed as the parents of twin boys born to a surrogate in Canada. Roman Catholic Italy lags behind most of Europe in its recognition of lesbian and gay couples. After years of pressure, lawmakers finally created less-than-equal civil partnerships for same-gender couples late last year. The legislation passed only after adoption rights were specifically denied. That forces gay and lesbian couples who want to be joint parents to non-biological children to plead their cases on a court-by-court basis.
Trump Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has supported so-called conversion therapy to make LGBT people straight, opposed marriage equality in her home state of Michigan, and never met a public school she liked. But she continues to occasionally surprise equality advocates. The acts that surprise may be nothing more than symbolic, however. She reportedly objected to the new administration's dumping of Obama-era guidelines to ensure the equal treatment of transgender students in public schools, but was overruled by Attorney General Jeff Sessions and others in the Trump cabinet. And this week, DeVos met with a small group of transgender children and their parents, who pressed her to make good on her promise during confirmation hearings to protect all students. 5-year-old trans girl Ellie Ford and her dad were among those talking to DeVos at the closed-door meeting, as was high school student Grace Dolan-Sandrino. Grace's mother, Karen Dolan, told reporters that the education secretary listened to our stories through our tears, and at times she seemed to appear visibly moved, but she didn't react. DeVos issued a statement after the meeting saying that she was grateful for the opportunity and that every school and every school leader has a moral responsibility to protect all students and ensure every child is respected and can learn in an accepting environment. I remain committed to advocating for and fighting on behalf of all students. Grace's mom, Karen Dolan, however, remains skeptical. There is one thing between increasing your understanding and having your heart moved for an hour, and then out of her position of power, either acting to protect transgender and gender nonconforming children, or acting in a way that will make their lives worse, she said. I haven't seen any concrete action that would give me any reason to be hopeful.
In other school-related news, lawmakers in Utah have repealed the law that banned classroom advocacy of homosexuality, a law that failed to provide specifics of what constituted advocacy. That led teachers to avoid directly confronting anti-queer bullying, for example, fearing such an action would violate that law. The statute was challenged in court by Equality Utah and the National Center for Lesbian Rights on behalf of several students and their parents. Progress in the case was delayed to give the legislature a chance to pass a repeal bill. If Republican Governor Gary Herbert signs it, the lawsuit could be vacated. Equality Utah Executive Director Troy Williams called it a historic day for LGBTQ students. The removal of discriminatory language from school curriculum, he said, will send a positive message that all students are valued in Utah. Activists hope that this week's legislative action will pressure lawmakers in Alabama, Arizona, Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas to consider repealing similar no-promo-homo laws in their states.
And finally, in more disquieting news, stepped-up vandalism and attacks on LGBT centers have paralleled similar increases in anti-Semitic acts across the U.S. since the election of Donald Trump, who ran a campaign based on animosity toward minority groups. Bomb threats have forced the evacuations of Jewish schools and community centers in more than a dozen states, and hundreds of tombstones were vandalized and overturned at Jewish cemeteries in Philadelphia and St. Louis. Obscene anti-queer graffiti was recently spray-painted across an entire wall of the Los Angeles LGBT Center. Vandals smashed a window at the office of Equality Florida in Orlando, a city now sadly associated with last year's massacre at the LGBT Pulse nightclub. Thugs have hit the LGBT Diverse and Resilient Center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 3 times in 2 months. Several windows were smashed at the headquarters in Asbury Park of New Jersey's LGBT Garden State Equality, and more than a dozen shots were fired from a pellet gun into the offices of the Equality Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Fortunately, no one was in the building at the time. The Tulsa World newspaper reported that this was the first time the Equality Center had been the target of vandalism in the 12 years since the LGBT rights group Oklahomans for Equality moved into the building. When asked for a comment by the Washington Blade newspaper about the escalating anti-LGBT attacks, a White House spokesperson, Kelly Love, said that President Trump condemns hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms, including attacks against the LGBT community.
Believe me.
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 Believe me, folks.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending March 11th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
Flushing out hate. Flushing out discrimination and ignorance and double standards, that is part of the necessary historical sweep of things.
Gay historian Stuart Timmons flushes out hate, discrimination, ignorance, and double standards after the latest on Gavin Grimm's quest to flush somewhere. Grimm's bathroom rights case will not be on the U.S. Supreme Court's immediate agenda as expected. Max Pringle of the Pacifica Evening News explains, and Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez continue the discussion in excerpts from Democracy Now!
The U.S. Supreme Court is returning a transgender teen's case to a lower court without reaching a decision. The justices said they've opted not to decide whether federal anti-discrimination law gives high school senior Gavin Grimm the right to use the boys' bathroom in his Virginia school. The case had been scheduled for argument in late March. Instead, a lower court in Virginia will evaluate the federal law, known as Title IX, and the extent to which it applies to transgender students. The court's action leaves in limbo the issue of transgender rights in school settings. Sarah Warbelow is legal director of the Human Rights Campaign, which advocates for LGBT rights.
This is not a loss for Gavin Grimm. It is not a loss for any other transgender student. It's simply justice delayed. It's going to take some time for the Supreme Court to hear either Gavin's case or another case, clarifying that trans students have a right to be free from discrimination in schools nationwide.
The Supreme Court action came after the Trump administration pulled back federal guidance advising schools to let students use the bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity.
Was Max Pringle.
The wolf will live with the lamb, and the leopard will lie with the goat, and the little child will lead them. A little child will lead them.
I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. To talk more about Monday's Supreme Court decision, we are joined by Gavin Grimm from a studio in Richmond, Virginia. Also with us here in New York, Chase Strangio, staff attorney at the ACLU. Gavin Grimm, can you respond to what the Supreme Court decided?
Well, it's definitely disappointing. It'll draw the process out a lot longer, which will leave a lot of kids in limbo. But we are as determined as ever to push forward, and if it takes 10 years, I'll stick with it.
Well, now you've become a national figure in many ways in terms of this case. Why do you think it's so important?
Well, transgender kids are an especially vulnerable population, being that in high school it's already difficult to get along, and especially if you don't fit some kind of mold, you're targeted to a greater degree than even normal. And then when you are in an environment where you're not being affirmed and when you're being separated and kept apart from your peers, not only does that send a very negative message to you, but it sends a very negative message to your peers and kind of conveys a precedent for how they'll treat you. So I think it's very important that we talk about rights of bathroom usage for trans youth, especially because if you can't use a bathroom, you can't participate in public life. And that's really what's at the center of this.
And what was your response last month when you heard the Trump administration was revoking the Obama administration's position on this issue?
It was very disappointing, certainly very frustrating, but I was just as determined as ever to push forward, as were, I think, everybody who's been working so hard on this case. But certainly it sent a very, very negative message to the trans youth of our nation.
How have your classmates, your teachers, family, friends, people you don't know, just run the gamut for us, how people have responded to you, Gavin?
Classmates have gotten a lot of support. Teachers have gotten a lot of support. Family have gotten a lot of support. Friends, of course, a lot of support. And then people I don't know, I'm approached almost every time I go out by at least one person who congratulates me and says how supportive they are of me. And this is in my community and outside of it. Even as far as North Carolina, I've been spotted and thanked and congratulated, whereas I've never once had a public confrontation that was negative.
And Gavin, you're a senior. You'll be graduating in the spring. Where do you hope to go to study, and what do you hope to do after college?
Well, I'm definitely pursuing higher education. And after college, I sort of right now what I'm thinking is a career stretch goal is I'd like to be a geneticist, and one day it would be nice to have my own practice.
And Chase, I wanted to ask you the importance of having a transgender youth who so eloquently can speak about the issues involved in his case and the importance of his case nationwide.
When I was growing up as a young trans person, I had no idea it was possible to sort of have a future as a trans adult. And now we have trans young people like Gavin leading our movements. They're out there in the state legislatures. They're bringing their cases to court. They are transforming our consciousness and our political systems. And they're absolutely going to be the people leading us into victory and justice on this issue in the end.
And what is your message, Gavin Grimm, to the Trump administration and to President Trump himself?
You know, I don't think that it's necessary to speak to the detractors. I think I want to promote a very positive message of support to other trans youth and definitely positivity. So I guess I'll go back to the message to trans youth everywhere, and that is, don't be disheartened. Keep your chin up. These things take time, but we are working towards equality every day.
Thank you, Gavin Grimm and Chase Strangio, for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
If you already long for the all-too-bygone days of the Trump-accused wiretapper-in-chief, have we got a special new show for you.
It began with hope, it epitomized change, and it ended with an unprecedented challenge. This Way Out follows Obama's rainbow reign, from the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to the Supreme Court marriage equality victory, to his anti-discrimination executive orders, and his call for renewed commitment in the future, all in a new collection of historic feature reports available now on CD.
We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states.
I am a fierce advocate for equality for gay and lesbian Americans.
We are not a nation that says, don't ask, don't tell. We are a nation that says, out of many, we are one.
I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
Welcome to the White House. This is the 8th Pride reception that we will celebrate together.
I don't think it is something that will be reversible.
Obama's Rainbow Reign. Get this special CD production, available only at thiswayout.org.
How could a population of gay people be so relatively useless now? Maybe useless is too harsh. Ineffectual. Invisible. No, useless is not too harsh. Oh, let us just call ourselves underutilized. I wish I could make all gay people everywhere, except this one fact that I know to be an undisputed truth. We are hated. We are the only people in America that it is socially acceptable to hate and discriminate against.
Larry Kramer's ACT UP 20th anniversary speech really did cause quite a stir in March of 2007, when we reviewed excerpts from his controversial address last time on This Way Out. It was because his call for a renaissance of street action resonates so well with the movement of today. In the same way, the current revival of hate and the inspiring activism of young leaders like Gavin Grimm also give renewed relevance to the way gay author-historian Stuart Timmons responded to the 2007 Kramer uproar a few weeks later in conversation with This Way Out's Lucia Chappell.
Would you say, from a historical perspective, that Kramer's acerbic rhetoric and the disavowals that have come afterward, is that new in the queer movement?
Absolutely not. It's one of the oldest stories never told, as I often say, about the deep culture of the queer movement. The kind of abrasive charisma that someone like Larry Kramer just brought out recently has been really a stock in trade. You go back 60 years to the founding of the Mattachine Society in 1950 with Harry Hay and Don Slater, who was the editor of One Magazine. Those personalities were known for their fire and brimstone, for their rubbing people the wrong way. Certainly Hay and Don Slater and Morris Kite, the godfather of gay liberation in Los Angeles, and Larry Kramer have been both adored and reviled for taking powerful stands, for becoming sort of alpha males in a community that often had no leadership before and everyone had their own fantasy that they were it. But the pioneering nature, a person who breaks new ground and articulates an injustice that everyone is feeling but no one is quite expressing or organizing about and figuring out how to address, that's a very, very tough thing to do. And I think it's just inescapable that there's going to be mistakes made along the way and people are going to be rubbed the wrong way. In the final analysis, it's the point to rub the power structure the wrong way and to sort of chafe the status quo so that things change. And if the immediate community gets rubbed the wrong way too, that's simply part of how history moves.
Do you think the pattern is kind of, you have the kind of a good cop, bad cop, good queer, bad queer?
To a large degree, Kramer used to express that exact perspective in talking about how ACT UP could be strategically effective, that you would have people who would be able to converse with government officials and people on boards of pharmaceutical industries and say, look, if you don't sit down and at least hear us out and maybe negotiate with us, we'll send ACT UP in here or out in front of your headquarters to shut you down. So there was some conscious development of that strategy, yeah. Silent candlelight vigils for several years were the primary way to express a response to AIDS. And the fact that the slogan for ACT UP became silence equals death was incredibly important. It was almost this organic expression of it wasn't just the government silence. It was the silence of the community that was following along with all these gains that had been made within the gay movement to meet with government officials, create 501c3s and community institutions, and qualify for grants and become more and more respectable and build up a treasury and appeal to the Republicans and conservatives in the community to donate their resources for all this important activism.
I'm Lucia Chappell for This Way Out, and my guest is gay historian Stuart Timmons. One of the things that I think freaked people out the most about what Kramer had to say was his assertion that they still hate us. Who are they?
Yeah, I guess I'm glad I don't live inside Larry Kramer's head. I have to say, honestly, that kind of sweeping statement comes from one's own perception, and I would dissect it all differently. There is an inevitable progress that is happening organically, and you can see it in the arts, you can see it in media, you can see it in education, you can see it in politics. You know, when George Bush says that he doesn't wish any violence on any gay people, despite whatever his noxious policies are, a president saying that gay people shouldn't be beat up is progress. I think you can see that there have been fundamental shifts and some fundamental progress. The fact that the bedrock of real day-to-day activism now exists in American high schools across the country and in the Midwest, that's a remarkable piece of progress. Flushing out hate or flushing out discrimination and ignorance and double standards, that is part of the necessary historical sweep of things. To me, and I think in the long view of history, it's never a shock to see that there's hatred or unequal treatment. The shock would be to pretend that it shouldn't exist anymore, and the tragedy would be to stop addressing it.
Stuart Timmons, gay historian, author of Gay LA, The History of Sexual Outlaws, Power Politics, and Lipstick Lesbians, and also The Trouble with Harry Hay, founder of the gay movement. Stuart, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
They are falling all around me. They are falling all around me.
Lucia Chappelle interviewed Stuart Timmons in 2007. The gay historian suffered a debilitating stroke the following year. With Herculean effort, he was able to return to his work preserving queer history and participated in the 2012 christening of the Mattachine Steps, an official Los Angeles landmark recognizing the neighborhood of Harry Hay. Stuart Timmons died this year on January 28th. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers, John Dyer V, and Lucia Chappelle contributed program material with thanks to Steve Pride and to Max Pringle on the Pacifica Evening News and Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez and Democracy Now! Betsy Hernandez and Sweet Honey in the Rock performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. And be sure to check out the new video promo there for Obama's Rainbow Ring. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Richard Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on South Waves Radio, Chichester, West Sussex, WOMR, Provincetown, Massachusetts, Radio Veronica, West Point, Pennsylvania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The United States is an ostensibly secular nation where church and state are kept separate. So how is it the currency is stamped in God we trust, and according to the Pledge of Allegiance, the U.S. is also a nation under God? The answer lies in a marriage between big business and Christianity, which has its origins in opposition to the New Deal, and which has evolved through the presidencies of Eisenhower, Nixon, Reagan, and now President Trump. Today, I'm joined by the historian of the right, Kevin Cruz, who teaches at Princeton University. He's the author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America, published by Basic Books. His other books include White Flight, Atlanta, and the Making of Modern Conservatism. Kevin, let me start by asking you this. There's an assumption, a common assumption, that Americans are and have been a church-going population. To what extent is that assumption correct?
Well, church-going population is an interesting phrase, and it's one that's kind of hard to measure. If we go by church membership rolls, it's actually not true. If we look back to the 19th century, for much of that, less than a fifth of Americans claim to regularly attend services. It creeps up over the course of the late 19th and early 20th century, but it only becomes a majority, really, in the post-World War II period, and only very briefly there.
Well, then, what changed? What drove the shift, if this is not the historical trend, if this is not somehow deeply embedded in the DNA of Americans, that they are religious and primarily Christian? What shifted in the early to mid-20th century?
Well, what shifts is there's a conscious campaign on the part of prominent figures, both in politics, but also, as I discovered, in religion, obviously, but also as I discovered in the business world, to try to get Americans to go to church. And so you see a concerted campaign from business leaders, from advertisers, from celebrities, urging Americans to take their faith more seriously and to wind it into not only their everyday lives, but to make it an explicit part of their nation's politics, too.
Well, perhaps you could set the stage about what was happening politically at the time. So you obviously had the Great Depression. There was the New Deal that really transformed American society in many ways, was embraced by many and alarmed many others. How did the New Deal shape the emergence of a different kind of active religiosity that was married with conservative politics?
Well, the story begins in an unlikely place. It begins in the kind of the boardrooms of major corporations. The New Deal had put big business on its heels, and it did so in two ways. The Great Depression had shattered the confidence Americans had had in businesses, which had been incredibly high in the 1920s. Businessmen were regarded as heroes, if not gods. That gets shattered with the stock market crash in 1929 and the 3 years of steadily increasing economic misery that follow. The New Deal then comes in, and it does two things that, from the perspective of business, is really alarming. They start to regulate business for the first time seriously from Washington, D.C., impinging on their economic freedom. And at the same time, they empower labor unions for the first time in a lot of these major industries. And what that does is suddenly business feels like it's getting it from without and within, and they're feeling constrained. So they launch a massive campaign to push back. And groups like the National Association of Manufacturers, for instance, a major industrial lobby, vastly increase the amount of money that they're spending on public relations. Really, I mean, they hire a public relations director for the first time for this purpose. And they start throwing out millions of dollars of work on a PR campaign that involves everything from a speaker series to ready-made articles and editorials for newspapers, advertisements, films, on and on. And the central message of this campaign early on is basically one built solely on economic arguments, that big business is good for the economy and we need to trust in it once again. The problem is that these arguments on behalf of big business come across like arguments on behalf of big business. They seem incredibly self-serving. So another of these groups was called the American Liberty Lobby, and it was heavily financed by groups like DuPont and General Motors. The problem was it sounded like it was financed by DuPont and General Motors. Jim Farley, the head of the Democratic Party, said they ought to call the American Liberty League the American Cellophane League because, number one, it's a DuPont product, and number two, you can see right through it. So all of these early campaigns that big business had thrown out, spending a vast amount of money, essentially falls on deaf ears. No one really is persuaded by this. They see right through it. They denounce it as propaganda. So business leaders decide they need to try a new tack. And by the late 30s, they are actively supporting a new set of spokesmen who are making the case on behalf of big business. But they do it in an interesting way. They make arguments that don't stress economics, they stress religion. And they do so because businessmen realize that the most trusted people in America at this time are ministers. They say this quite explicitly. Therefore, we should get ministers to make the case for us. And those ministers make a case based on religious freedom. They make an argument that the New Deal represents the slavery of the state. And as opposed to that, you have business representing freedom under God.
Obviously, with the religious right, we've seen for a long time a marriage of religion and big business. But on the face of it, Christianity and free enterprise seem like strange bedfellows. Was that the case? Was this marriage of these two seamless for them, or were there tensions that existed in trying to pull these two together?
There are definite tensions, because at the time of the New Deal, many religious leaders rallied around the New Deal and its regulation of business. They They argued, as the head of the Federal Council of Churches did, the main umbrella organization of Protestant churches, that the New Deal is essentially embodying Christian principles, such as the importance of food and shelter. Give us our daily bread. They said that's essentially what the New Deal is doing. So business leaders have to find ministers who will take a more creative approach with Scripture, and they do. They find, in particular, one of the people I single out early on and one of the key people here, is a Congregationalist minister out of Los Angeles by the name of Reverend James W. Fifield. And Fifield is politically conservative, but theologically liberal. He had no patience for fundamentalists who read the Bible literally. In fact, he said, we've got to sift through the Bible. We've got to discard these warnings about the dangers of wealth, that a rich man will never get into heaven. That's not true, he says. And so he says we've got to approach the Bible like we eat fish. We take the bones out to enjoy the meat. All parts are not of equal value. So again, he discards hundreds of passages in which Christ makes condemnations of wealth and power, and instead finds a way that reconciles his vision of Christianity with capitalism. And he does so through a political framework. This is where the politics comes into it, because he says, look, Christianity and capitalism are both systems that value the individual above all else. In Christianity, an individual soul rises to heaven or falls to hell based on its own merit. That's a slight theological ugliness, but that's what he argues. In business, if you're good at business, you make a profit. If you're bad at business, you go to the poorhouse. So they're both systems in which the individual rises or falls on their own. The New Deal, he says, violates that, because it's a form of pagan statism that violates, again, that sacred freedom under God, that freedom to rise or fall on your own.
Was it the case that these ministers were conservative to start with, and hence the idea of joining forces with the business class seemed appealing?
Yeah, most of them were. Most of them. So Fifield's a good example. Fifield's church, First Congregational Church in Los Angeles, is the largest congregational church in the country at the time. It's also, I think, probably one of the richest. He is literally ministering to millionaires. In fact, he reveled in that identity. He was he called himself the apostle to millionaires, St. Paul to the prosperous. He revels in this, and he lives personally the life of the wealthy. He has a giant three-story mansion on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. And so he sympathizes with this very rich and in the Depression-era Los Angeles, very conservative congregation he has. And he tries to minister to their needs, and he does so by telling them that their political worldview is one he shares, and one that, in fact, Christ shares.
You just mentioned Los Angeles. Was there a geographical component to the backlash against the New Deal? Were these business and religious leaders concentrated in particular parts of the country?
Los Angeles crops up time and time again, but it really is all over. I've got another a major figure who comes out of Seattle. Chicago figures in a lot of this. Norman Vincent Peale in New York City. Billy Graham is a mixture of North Carolina and Wheaton, Illinois. So it really is a movement that takes place all over. And it's one that really sees this not as something that is going to have a certain regional base that we might expect when we think about later manifestations of the religious right, really rooted in the South and the Midwest. This is something that is actually born all over the country.
You just mentioned evangelist Billy Graham, who had a very long history going across the terms of many, many presidents. What was his role in this fusion of Christianity and free enterprise, and how influential was he in shaping a kind of new sort of politics?
He's hugely important, and we've largely thought of Billy Graham and sort of his later manifestations, but we have to remember that when he came on the scene in 1949 as a 30-year-old evangelist, he was very much a part of this movement we're talking about, this movement that I call Christian libertarianism in the book. His early rallies, his early crusades, as he called them, were filled with condemnations of organized labor and praise for big business. He tells a rally in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1952 that the Garden of Eden was a paradise in which there were no labor leaders, no union dues, no snakes, and no disease. He tells a crowd in Boston that the kind of religious revival that he's calling for in America is one in which a worker won't strike against his boss, in which a worker will put in a good, honest 8-hour workday, and then go home. Business leaders, meanwhile, he constantly likens to the most esteemed religious figures you can imagine. He constantly is calling for them to be recognized as people whose worldly success is a sign of their favor from God.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by historian Kevin Cruz. We're talking about the history in the 20th century of the fusion of the Christian right and the corporate right. So under Eisenhower, who, though a Republican, did not seek to dismantle the New Deal, he created a sort of significant shift, which is that prior to him, against the New Deal, there had been a fusion of free enterprise and Christianity against the state. But under Eisenhower, that shifted so that actually the state became the embodiment of religious and Christian values. How did that shift take place?
Well, it takes place largely through a pivot Eisenhower makes himself. So he gets elected with the help of these Christian libertarian groups. So Fifield's group, which is called Spiritual Mobilization, Abraham Faraday, who is the force behind the National Prayer Breakfast as it comes into being under Eisenhower, and Billy Graham especially, is a constant source of advice, feeding him scripture lines and themes to talk about on the campaign trail. And Eisenhower is a true believer when it comes to this Christian libertarianism. The problem is once he gets into office, he quickly realizes, he quickly decides he will make peace with the New Deal. In fact, he writes a famous letter to his brother, Milton, where he says, if any party does away with labor legislation and Social Security and things like that, you'll never hear from that party again in our lifetime. It's just not going to happen. And in fact, he greatly expands the New Deal. He strengthens Social Security. He oversees the biggest public works project of the post-war era, the federal highway system. He does a lot to actually deepen the New Deal state, and his former libertarian allies are furious. What Eisenhower does, though, is he doesn't abandon the religious language that they'd used. He flips its purpose around. They had always used that religious language of freedom under God as a way to challenge the state, to tear down the state. Eisenhower takes it and spins it around and instead uses it to prop up the state. And so an early theme of his presidency, which emerges at that very first National Prayer Breakfast that he presides over in February 1953, the theme is government under God. So previously it had been freedom under God as opposed to a godless government. And instead he makes it a government under God and makes the state itself sacred.
What did the big business that had been supporting this opposition to the New Deal, how did they react to Eisenhower? Or were they in more of a minority, since quite a lot of the business class seemed to have reconciled itself by that point with an economy that is regulated and the role of labor unions as they were in the 50s?
Some of them are furious, but most of them, as you note, had made peace with the New Deal state by that point. And most of them recognized that for all of his expansions of the New Deal, Eisenhower did actually roll back some federal regulations of business. And the labor laws had changed before he was even in power. So that was no longer really a pressing concern. And they generally were happy with the large scale prosperity of the era. And so they were making enough profit that they didn't, that they weren't worried about that kind of libertarian drive.
So tell us about how there was a shift under Eisenhower. You mentioned a moment ago that Eisenhower initiated prayer breakfasts for presidents, which already seems quite strange when you reflect on separation of church and state. And then, of course, he supported legislation to add the phrase under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, embracing In God We Trust as the nation's official motto. How did he initiate these things, and what was his agenda in doing so?
Well, Eisenhower's agenda here is one in which, and I think it's quite sincere, is that he believes that religious faith can be a unifying force in America, and that it helps explain its institutions. So he's got a famous line that he gives, and he gives it to one of these Christian libertarian groups when he's president-elect in December 1952. And he famously says, "Our form of government makes no sense unless it's founded on a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is." Now, religious critics mock him for this. William Lee Miller, who's a liberal theologian at Yale, says, apparently President Eisenhower is a very fervent believer in a very vague religion. And they used it to kind of mock the substance of Eisenhower's faith. But I think Eisenhower actually was onto something there, because he knew that the only way in which religion could work in American politics is if it was expansive and almost intentionally vaguely drawn. And so that's why you see all the things that happen in his presidency, from the National Prayer Breakfast to the addition of Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, In God We Trust on paper currency and stamps, and then becomes the national motto. All these various things that happen, and there are many more. They're all drawn at that broad level. They're drawn in what legal scholars would later call ceremonial deism. And they use that term to mean a ceremonial, from their eyes, that it wasn't important. It was merely ornamental, and therefore the law couldn't handle it. But deism was key, in that the deity was always vaguely drawn. You never had formal invocations. Well, sometimes you did, but almost never you had formal invocations of Jesus Christ. It was rather a God that could be embraced by what was increasingly referred to at the time as the three great faiths of democracy: Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism. But there's also space made into that. Occasionally they explicitly make space for Muslims, for Buddhists, for Hindus. And so there's a sense of the religious diversity here. It's only really non-believers who are kind of seen on the outside here. Eisenhower's minister says, an atheistic American is a contradiction in terms. You simply can't be one. But so he does this broad, inclusive faith, and he sees it as a way to unite Americans. And in this, he's both a pioneer and he isn't. There had been a move underway really from the 1920s to think about the connections between Protestants, Catholics, and Jews in America. And it really takes off during World War II, when the government is trying to find ways to unite Americans and downplay the ways that divide them. What divides them are their old ethnic loyalties to their nations of origin. So, you know, if you're a German American and you have a French American neighbor, World War II is a divisive topic for you. If you, however, come together on your shared Christian faith, you've got something that unites you. And so they started in World War II to advance that. Eisenhower, who had seen this at work during the war, picks this up and makes it a major theme of his presidency. In fact, I'd say it basically defines his first 100 days, if we think about the important ways in which presidents set their presidencies off, from his inauguration actually this time of year around February of 1953. He is involved nonstop in promotional campaigns to get Americans to embrace faith.
Well, despite the breadth, the sort of big tent of the religion, especially for Christians, but even maybe beyond Christianity, was there any resistance, any substantial resistance, to injecting religion into the state in such a way, given that, as you are arguing, this is not actually the long history of the United States?
Surprisingly, no. At the start, the only conflict over some of these things comes from who's going to get credit. So the debate over adding Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance is instructive. It happens with incredible speed. The only thing that slows it down is basically sponsors in Congress fighting over whose bill is going to be the one they all rally around. And it's Democrats and Republicans, it's liberals and conservatives, it's Catholics and Protestants and Jews. They're all involved in this. They all rally behind this. The agencies that you think might and the organizations you think might object to this simply don't. The ACLU only learns about the change to the national motto after it's passed the House. It's already almost done before they even hear about it, and they have some internal discussion of, should we challenge this? No, we've actually got bigger issues to deal with. You know, this is the era when they're focused on McCarthyism, and that's the real peril in their eyes. This doesn't seem like a huge civil liberties issue. Meanwhile, Americans United for Separation of Church and State was at this time known by its original name, which was Protestants and Other Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And as that name implies, they weren't worried about a general embrace of religion. They were worried about Catholics getting taxpayer money for parochial schools. So this kind of broad embrace of the sacred is fine. It's when a particular sect gets an advantage, that's the problem. And again, that doubles back to Eisenhower's comment. As long as you've kept this at a broad, vague level of God in which no individual faith feels like it's being singled out for benefit or being penalized, then all these forces will come together around it. Once you get into a much more divisive issues, and those come later, then trouble starts to brew.
Why did religiosity increase in the 1950s amongst Americans? Was it because it was state-sanctioned, or were there other dynamics going on in the society as well? And did that increased religiosity apply primarily to white Americans, Americans across the board?
It's really Americans across the board. And there are... If you ask an historian why something happened, we'll say, yes, it's all these reasons, right? And so there are a lot of different factors we can point to here. The state's embrace of it is one thing, and the contrast they make with the Soviet Union is key here. This campaign had been underway for decades before, but it really catches fire in the 50s as the government is really promoting a concept of Americanism that is defined largely in opposition to what the Soviet Union is. The Soviet Union is godless and atheistic. Sometimes they use those words at the same time, godless, atheistic, communist. And therefore, a good American has to be godly. So there's an encouraging of taking religion. But it comes from the government. But it also comes from business leaders. It comes from – there's a massive advertising campaign promoted by business leaders called Religion in American Life, which instructs Americans that it's their duty as parents, their duty as good citizens, to be involved in their local church or synagogue. And at the same time, you see a surge in pop culture here. The 50s are a moment in which many of the best-selling books are religious-themed. Many of the blockbuster movies are religious themes. So The Ten Commandments is one of the biggest movies of all time. Still, it's got one of the, I think, the top 10 box offices. It is a religious epic, obviously, but it's one with a political motive in mind. Cecil B. DeMille, the producer-director of that film, was a member of James Fifield's church. He had been an active supporter of this cause of Christian libertarianism for decades. And he says that the theme of the Ten Commandments, and he says that explicitly in interviews and even in a short film clip they show before the film is shown in theaters, he says this story is basically one of, are men going to be slaves to the state, or are they going to be free souls under God? So he really just captures this earlier Christian libertarian theme. But again, it's a promotional campaign that takes place behind this movie. It gets this movie out, and it's widely popular. And part of the promotional campaign is the setting up of Ten Commandment monuments all across the country. And so there are about 4,000 of these concrete monuments stone monuments are set up across the country. They later become the subject of fights over separation of church and state, as some of these are literally part of city halls and courthouses. But at the time, they're incredibly popular. At the time, they're largely uncontroversial because they seem to embody and embrace this larger rush to religiosity. And so over the course of the 50s, you've got all these different sources, the government, business, advertisers, pop culture, all leading Americans, encouraging them to go back to church, to go back to their synagogue. And so you see an incredible surge in religious attendance. Now, the problem is that attendance number can be misleading because if we look below the surface, sometimes the religion can seem thin. So polls showed that vast majorities believed in the divinity of Christ, 80% or more. Then follow-up questions asked those same people who fervently believed in the divinity of Christ to name any one of the Gospels. And something like 30% could only name one. So it shows a religiosity that is incredibly broad, but I think also at the same time quite thin.
You mentioned popular culture a moment ago. Tell us about Walt Disney and Disneyland.
Well, Walt Disney and Disneyland, Disney is, again, another of these men who fit into this libertarian mold, who think of themselves as outspoken Christians who have something to say on this topic. And with Disneyland, which was, I think we forget what a novel and an amazing development it was at the time. He opens up Disneyland and has a theme that we now know as the Hall of Presidents, which you see at Disney World. But originally it was going to be called One Nation Under God. And he was going to use these animatronic displays, again, high-tech, incredibly impressive at the time, to spread this message that America was essentially a Christian nation, that it always had been.
I'm Sasha Lilly. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And today I'm speaking with Kevin Cruz. He's professor of history at Princeton University and the author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. That's published by Basic Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. So if Eisenhower tried to unite Americans with his marriage of the state and religion, Richard Nixon and his allies sought to drive a wedge between them. What did this fusion of Christianity and conservative politics look like in Nixon's hands, and what was going on in the 1960s that shaped these debates?
Well, Nixon, we have to remember, was Eisenhower's vice president. And so he had literally had a front row seat to these events that had happened in the Eisenhower administration, the creation of One Nation Under God, the National Prayer Breakfast. He is right there and witnessing what Eisenhower can do. So he knows the power of these political religious rituals, right? When he comes into office, he tries to recreate them, but he does them in a very Nixonian way. He does them not to bring Americans together. He rather uses this language of religious nationalism as a way to advance his own policies in a kind of America love it or leave it approach. So he does this in a number of ways. His inauguration is one that uses religion to really play up the themes of the silent majority. And then he does so at events like the National Prayer Breakfast. But then he goes even further than Eisenhower had done, and he starts having actual church services in the East Room of the White House. And behind the scenes, his aides say this was crassly political. We did this solely to score political points with the press, with certain members of our base, to woo congressmen on certain issues. So the guest lists are done in a way in which they bring together a congressman they want to lobby with people who will help sway their opinion on things. And again, these are topics far removed from what you might think of as religious issues. The anti-ballistic missile treaty is one. The sales tax changes is another one. And so they're constantly bringing these people together to hear sermons from conservative ministers, always conservative ministers. Billy Graham was a regular guest, but they get a lot more there to preach a message that is promotes the silent majority, but also they use this moment to build a kind of silent majority community in these church services that seems entirely wholesome, that brings together millionaire donors, congressmen they want to sway, and conservative icons in politics and pop culture, and they bring them all together in the White House to promote this. It at the time is condemned as kind of a clumsy PR thing, but it's incredibly effective. It becomes a very popular activity among his constituents. Another way he does this is he holds rallies with Billy Graham, and Billy Graham had always been associated with the presidency, really. From Eisenhower on, he had a kind of disastrous visit with Harry Truman. But from Eisenhower on, he's a mainstay in the White House, both Republicans and Democrats. And he does so by maintaining a slightly less political tone than he'd originally had. With Nixon, though, he goes all in. He had known Nixon, again, since the 50s, since the Eisenhower administration, considered him a close friend, and really throws his prestige behind the president. And so when the Nixon administration comes under fire during the war on Vietnam, particularly after the invasion of Cambodia and then the slaying of four students at Kent State in May 1970, he leans hard on Billy Graham. And he gets Graham to do two things. One, to hold a massive rally with him in the football stadium, Neyland Stadium, at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, with 100,000 something people in attendance. And then he gets Graham to work with Bob Hope to hold this massive rally on the 4th of July in 1970 called Honor America Day. And both are sold to the public as technically non-political events. That one is just a celebration of public faith. The other one is a 4th of July celebration of America. But both events take on a very partisan tone and are very clearly seen as ways to promote not public faith or patriotism, but to promote President Richard Nixon and to defend him from his critics. And that if you do believe this is one nation under God, if you do believe our motto is in God we trust, then you should put your faith not just in God, but in the head of this government, and that's Richard Nixon.
In the 1970s, there was a profit crunch. And I wonder how the relationship between the corporate right, corporate elites or the business elite, and the religious right was reconfigured at that time. To what degree did it need to be reconfigured, and to what degree did that take place?
When we think about the forces that lead together to the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, it brings together different strands of conservatism, and two of the key ones are the religious right and the business forces, which seek more of a libertarian approach to government. And so they come back together on the grounds of this kind of Christian libertarianism, and they find an alliance that is much like the one they had during the New Deal, where whatever their differences on key issues, they both agree they want to get the government out of their lives. So for social conservatives, it's getting the government out of their private Christian schools. It's rolling back abortion rights. It's rolling back feminism. It's rolling back gay rights. It's changes like that. For business conservatives, it's rolling back the regulatory state, which had grown under Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. And so there's a real concerted move here to come together and to come behind the rallying cry that Ronald Reagan gives in the 1980 campaign of getting government off our backs. And they both agree on that. And so they very easily form a coalition that is has a kind of an anti-government animus at its heart.
Who were the foot soldiers of the Reagan Revolution? Speaking of the people, the evangelicals and other Christians who ended up supporting this term, participating in it. What was the basis of it in terms of race, in terms of class? Who were these people?
Well, in terms of race, it's overwhelmingly white. There's a significant contingent of Asian Americans, small numbers of African Americans, Latinos, but it's an overwhelmingly white constituency. In terms of his class, it actually cuts across class lines. You've got clearly kind of the traditional establishment Republicans of business leaders who fall behind the Republican Party constantly. You've got middle class suburbanites who had really been there since the days of Eisenhower. And then you've got more kind of the white working class, what we think of as classically as the Reagan Democrats, who rally around a Reagan as somebody who will stand up for them and their needs, as somebody who will push back against economic decline, push back against an increasing view that America was weak on the world stage, and plays to their need for a kind of a stark patriotic appeal. So it's one that really goes across class lines, but is still, in terms of race, overwhelmingly white.
What about denominations? We tend to associate evangelical Christians with the religious right. Who else denominationally was part of that alliance?
Well, evangelical Christians are a huge part. You've got obviously large numbers of fundamentalists, but increasingly you've got conservative Catholics being brought into this coalition, and Mormons as well. And these groups come together in uneasy alliances in the 1970s. and they're deeply distrustful at first. Evangelicals think Catholics are essentially pagans. They think the Mormons are a cult. They have different views on the issues. When Roe v. Wade happens, Catholics are deeply concerned with the issue of abortion. Most Protestants, including evangelicals, don't think it's a big issue. Early polls of the 1970s of the Southern Baptist Convention, for instance, show 70 to 80% of pastors and lay members there are fine with legalized abortion. So they're originally on different pages and they're hostile to each other. But over the course of the 70s, they come to see that they have a common enemy. And that's what really unites them. They come to see that the state is increasingly involved in their lives as they see it, and for negative reasons. And so they rally around this idea that they should all be together. And they do so again. It harkens back to how Eisenhower understood religion. They do so by downplaying the theological and doctrinal differences between their faiths. The moral majority, which is the most significant group here, Jerry Falwell's organization, they get their name from a moment in a meeting in which one of the organizers says, well, out there must be a moral majority who believes in the principles of the Decalogue, who believes in the Ten Commandments. And if you boil it down to that basic foundation of faith, you get beyond what divides Baptists from Methodists, from Catholics, from Assembly of God people. You really get down to that fundamental core that they can all basically agree on. If you actually push them on this, they realize they have different texts for this, depending on the different Bibles. But they agree that in theory there's this vague, basic, fundamental faith that unites them. And once they make that their point of contact, they come together.
My guest is Kevin Cruz. He's a historian, author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I'd like to spend the rest of the time that we have talking about the religious right, the intersection of corporate and religious interests as they manifest today in the era of Donald Trump. How do you understand Trump's take on religion? Obviously, he's not exactly a role model of Christian piety or upstanding behavior, and yet he has quite a solid basis of support from at least evangelical whites. How do you understand his support from these people?
Well, clearly it's a support that's based on a kind of a transactional relationship. He had very light support early on in the campaign. He had a great number of evangelical leaders who were outspoken and hostile to him early on. He had some who were in his corner early, Jerry Falwell Jr., for instance. But it wasn't until the summer of 2016 that he really got evangelicals and the leaders of the religious right behind him. And he did so by explicitly promising that he would name a Supreme Court justice who would overturn Roe v. Wade. He sent out a list of actual names of judges, which a candidate I don't believe has ever done before, to assure them that if they voted for him, that he would give them what they wanted most, which was a judge to fill the Scalia vacancy, who would be stridently anti-Roe.
Well, let's talk about Trump's religious nationalism. He is not someone who seems deeply rooted himself in any kind of religiosity, but as you say, he has commanded the support from various religious people. Certainly, his politics are steeped very deeply in nationalism. If you look at Nixon and you look at Trump, how would you say that their take on religious nationalism is similar or differs?
I think Trump's a lot like Nixon here in that he's very clearly using religious nationalism for his own political ends. And also, I think, like Nixon, in fact, more than Nixon, is using it cynically. Nixon had been raised as a Quaker and occasionally came back to that faith. He noted when he held these events that he was, you know, quote, I just gave him some of the God stuff. He's very cynical about it when people talk about the comments he made. Trump is, I think, very much in that vein. But I think it's even more pronounced. Trump's own background, he says he was a Presbyterian who attended Reverend Norman Vincent Peale's Marble Collegiate Church. But there's actually no record of him being a regular member of any Presbyterian church or Marble Collegiate. Still, he speaks about this this faith animating me, animating him. He may bungle the references a lot. He's famously called out for 2 Corinthians rather than 2 Corinthians, and got a lot of criticism for that. But he still, regardless of his inability to kind of articulate that faith, he understands the role of rituals of faith. And so for him, the faith has never really seemed to be a personal thing, but he understands its place in our polity. And what he does with this embrace of religious nationalism is he uses it as a way to, I think, essentially further his real goal, which is nationalism. And so the religious angle becomes a way to sell this. And he does so through associations with people like Franklin Graham. Billy Graham had embraced religious nationalism, but again, had done so in a very inclusive way. Billy Graham had always spoken about all the faiths coming together, had made room for Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, had really had an expansive understanding of this. With Franklin Graham, it's less of a embrace of a broad religious tradition, and it's more exclusively a Christian nationalism. And that's a real narrowing of this viewpoint, and one that clearly animates the ways in which Trump thinks about things like the immigration ban. And we should note that that's actually an issue which has caused the support from evangelicals to splinter. The National Association of Evangelicals and other leaders in the evangelical movement have been outspoken in condemning the immigration ban because they've actually been strongly engaged with protecting refugees. So they see this as, I think, many Christians would. They see this as the duty of a good Christian to take care of the stranger, to take care of the refugee. There are countless places in the New Testament they can look for authority on that, and it's not easy for them to shrug it off.
Well, religiosity in the United States is on the decline amongst younger generations, and clearly, just looking at the present moment, Trump can be a very chaotic figure. You've written that the base for the religious right is becoming more divided, and I wonder what you think this means for the future of the right and of conservatism and religion, both in this moment and then looking further ahead.
Well, I think there's a real, for all the dominance that the Republicans have now at every level of government, at all 3 branches, they control the presidency, they control Congress, they control the Supreme Court. I think there's a real fragility there in some ways, in that that masks both internal divisions they have, but also presents them with a unified a government that they haven't had since 1928 when they looked invincible, and then their fortunes quickly changed with the Great Depression. So we're seeing in terms of their political coalition is at a moment of apparent strength right now, but again, those large numbers breed large groups of internal divisions, which they'll be fighting out for control of that, which can be problematic to the overall coalition. On the point of religion, there's a generational problem here, is that while many of the old religious right leaders came to rally around Trump, James Robeson, James Dobson, Tony Perkins, Jerry Falwell Jr., people like that, Franklin Graham, well, they've rallied around Trump. They've done so at the real risk, and I think the real cost, of alienating younger evangelicals who increasingly don't want to have this kind of role in politics. So I think the next generation of even conservative evangelicals are going to be much less likely to be involved in politics, especially if the Trump administration comes to be seen as anything less than a sterling success. If they don't get everything they're hoping for at this moment, if those promises that their leaders have made don't come true, I think you're going to see a real rebellion on the ranks of the new generation of evangelicals.
And that would be a huge blow to the Republican Party, because just looking at the figures for white voters in the past presidential election, that evangelicals voted disproportionately for Trump. And if you factored out white evangelicals, that the remaining non-evangelical whites voted by a majority for Clinton. But the thing that was particularly interesting in those numbers was that white evangelicals turn out at much higher numbers than the rest of the population. So in a sense, they're punching above their weight. And yet, if their numbers are declining, and as you mentioned, if there's this generational divide, then that seems like something that for the Republican Party could be very significant, perhaps even in the more near future rather than, you know, many years down the road.
I think that's right. I mean, again, if you look at the key basis of support right now within the Republican Party, it's a population that skews much older than the general voting public. And so if they don't have this new generation of evangelicals to come in as not just regular voters, but kind of foot soldiers for mobilizing other voters, there's going to be a huge cost when those older voters are gone and these younger voters haven't come in to take the place.
Do you think that there is any sense of urgency, therefore, amongst conservative religious leaders to try and get everything that they can get at this point, given that demographically things don't look so good? And then connected to that, obviously there are many corporate interests that have no connection to the religious right, but for those that do you think there's some unease there in terms of what the future holds?
Well, you know, I'm an historian, so I'm trained in hindsight. It's difficult
sure.
for me to predict the future, but I'd say that we are at a moment that I think shows the real ways in which contingency matters, and I think both of those trends could be potentially incredibly problematic for the party. We've seen corporate America and the religious right are no longer in lockstep. You saw this with the ways in which different corporations came out against the so-called religious liberty laws in states like Arkansas and Indiana that would have authorized discrimination against LGBT individuals. NASCAR came out against that. Walmart came out against that. Things that would have seemed unimaginable a decade or so ago, they're clearly realizing that their consumer base, that their customers don't want these things necessarily, and therefore they're not going to abide by them. So we've seen a rift between corporate America, even conservative corporate America, even Walmart, again, headed by a family that carries its religion very close to itself. So you've seen a split here. And so I think there is a danger of this coalition fractioning. It's very fragile.
Let me end by asking you about religion that isn't tethered to the Republican Party or to the right. You've noted that Democrats also use the language of religion and Christianity at that, looking at Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. Why do you think that is the case? Is this just the long history of, at least going back to mid-century, to Eisenhower, this sort of fusion of the American state with religion? Do you think that religious nationalism has a life of its own separate from the Republican Party? Or are there other reasons that in a country where church and state are supposed to be separate, that people in both parties evoke religion in politics?
I'll look back and I'll look forward. So if we look back even beyond the Eisenhower era, we have to remember that the New Deal that these Christian libertarians railed against was itself sold in religious terms. Franklin D. Roosevelt loved to make religious analogies. His first inaugural address was so filled with religious references that the National Bible Reporter printed out the entire text with arrows and loops going to the various bits of scripture that the president had invoked. And he could a speech on something dry like water utilities. He would condemn private water powers, and his speech began, "My sermon today comes from the Old Testament. My text is, thou shalt not steal." In his second inaugural, he referred to himself basically as Moses leading the American people to a promised land. So liberals used to use this religious language. And so I think when you see someone like Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, who did it even, I think even more than Obama did, really speak about the role of faith in their lives, that goes back to an older tradition. The problem for the left here Isn't that liberalism and religious faith are incompatible? Far from it. If you look back to the old social gospel of the New Deal era, you see that religion can be a real tool here. The problem is that the Democratic Party's base is becoming increasingly fractured on this issue of religion. And so you have, as you note, large numbers of people who categorize themselves as secular, as agnostic, as atheist. That's quickly becoming about a fifth of the electorate, and it's largely on the Democratic side. So for a Democratic leader to try to navigate between these deeply religious liberals and deeply irreligious liberals, or on the far left, that becomes a delicate line to walk. And we saw Obama try to do this when he made what was unusual at the time, a reference to believers and non-believers. So to go against that old Eisenhower refrain in which an atheistic American was a contradiction in term, Obama made it clear you could be an atheistic American, and that changed nothing about your patriotism. But it means that the line that Democratic leaders have to walk is a very delicate one, because they've got to reach out to both the religious and the irreligious, and it's not a problem you see with Republicans in the right.
I've been speaking in this hour with Kevin Cruz. He's professor of history at Princeton University. His books include White Flight, Atlanta, and the Making of Modern Conservatism, and he's the author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. That's published by Basic Books, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.